Morning, Brandon.
Got you on the record.
We can hear you. Anyway, good morning. So today is December 5th, and it's a Thursday. It's kind of like Fairbanks weather out there. It's like 10 degrees, Bernie.
I think we're 20 below.
I think you brought something down with you.
He's 20 below.
I'd like to call our meeting to order, and I'd like to ask Kren to do the roll call for the board members.
Okay. Ms. Sandy, here. Deputy Commissioner Samarowski.
Here.
Mr. Kennedy.
Here.
Mr. Fogel. Commissioner Anderson. Mr. Carl.
Here.
Mr. Pruse.
Here.
You got a quorum.
Thank you. Would you continue with staff and the public, please?
Okay. Let's start.
Tom Buchan, Ada.
Back corner over there.
So Donna Lindley, I can type.
Jeff San Juan, Ada.
Mark Davis, Ada.
Jennifer Payne Dowell. Lindsay, Ada.
Jerry Judet, Department of Law.
Amy Kubik, Ada.
Sherry Peterson, Ada.
Ruth Benioniza, Trilogy. Stuart Osgood, Dowell.
Ruth Kempinen, Ada. Do we have any public on the phone?
All right, thanks, Grin. So we have a work session agenda in front of us. I'll take a motion and put it on the floor. You're going to have to lead the charge today, Bernie.
Oh, I'll make a motion that we accept the work session as presented.
The agenda?
The agenda is presented.
Is there a second? Thank you. Any objections?
Don't.
Any objections? Hearing none, the agenda is approved. Brings us to public comments. Anybody online want to make a public comment? Anybody online? Anybody in the audience, in the room here? I will close the public comment section. That brings us to the actual work session part of it. And up first is the Ambler Mining District Industrial Access Project presentation. Tom?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. And I'm going to turn it over to Mark Davis and Jeff San Juan, and they can introduce Rick, too. Okay. And
I would ask that if someone's going to talk, we don't talk from the back seats, that if someone's going to do some value adding for us, good questions, that they come up so they're on the microphone, we can get on the record.
Well, good morning. For the record,
morning, Jeff.
Good morning. For the record, Jeff San Juan, project manager for the Ambler Mining District Industrial Access Project. And in the room today, we actually have our major contractor, Dow, Stuart Osgood from Dow, and Jen Payne from Dow as well. And then we have Trilogy, because there's a section in our presentation that actually talks about the mining district. And so Trilogy is here to answer any questions in regards to the piece of the mining district. So,
okay. So when you say major contractor, I assume they're doing the work associated with the record of decision and the access, the permitting side.
Correct. So from the permitting side, from
design or
from ADA standpoint, Dow is the third party contractor assisting ADA in the preparation and answering the questions on the EIS.
Okay.
So they're our contractor.
Okay.
All righty. So we'll jump in here. So executive summary. So ADA was created for opportunities like Ambler. You know, I think when we think back of the DMTS and when we started in 1985, a lot of the enabling legislation that ADA has as far as tools when it comes to procurement methods, being able to do sole source contracting, being able to own and operate entities came about because of DMTS. And so we're kind of in the supreme role of being able to not only develop, but have a model that we can develop on. And from a project standpoint, this project is pretty complex. You know, we don't really know everything about it yet. And there are many federal, state, local laws that ADA must adhere to in order to be able to finally construct this road. And there are many stakeholders in the region. We have two different regions, Northwest Arctic Borough, and then we have an unorganized region that we're a part of as well that we're crossing. But ultimately, the project's worth it. I think that the, based upon the findings from different NI 43-101s, there looks to be about $26 billion worth of estimated resources in the ground.
So Jeff,
yes.
If I can address that one bullet point. So at $26 billion, was that the original estimate? Is that the current estimate? Do you expect the estimate to change or grow? Where are we at on that?
So Rick could probably speak more to this, but when we first started the project in 2011, and based upon the data that they provided when we started, it was about $13 to $14 billion worth of resources back in 2011. And as the project kept on moving forward, the mining entities kept exploring. And as they explored more and more resources were uncovered. And so I actually think it's a lot higher than that.
Is that retail $26 billion?
That $26 billion is based upon NI 43-101 studies. Based upon it's what investors take stock in when they look at investing in mining companies. If a company has
gross revenue.
That's gross based upon correct. It is. Okay. It's just based on a mineral resource and a price on our mineral resources.
You're more welcome to step in anytime, Rick.
I'll just say we'd call it a value in the ground. So it's metal in the ground. That's what it's worth at today's market prices.
So that's in the ground, not at the smelter or?
Correct.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so it's a gross value.
Okay.
We can't talk about that for securities reasons. So
you guys can.
So on the agenda this morning is I wanted to kind of talk about kind of Ada's role in the project, a little bit about the project itself, going into a little more about the district, the mining district, as well as what we heard during the draft EIS and what our response was to the draft EIS. And then lastly, we want to talk about the funding and path forward. So Ada's role. And so Ada's role in the project is to really support exploration and development of the 75-mile mining district. So we're really there to promote job, economic development, and just provide alternative sources of revenue for the state. So in Ada's policy...
Yeah, so should we open the door up, Ken and Sherry?
It's not.
Or are we going to strip down to...
John, it'll take a while to kick in.
You think we could just like set the thermostat? That's what most people do.
Yeah.
It went up and it heated everything up. Now we want to cool it down.
Yeah.
Oh, is that how we do it?
Yeah. And then you're going to tell me
open the doors. We open the doors. Okay. Whoa, I like this. And how much did we pay for this remodel?
Not enough.
Sorry, I'm glad you got. I'm sorry, folks. You shouldn't have heard that. That's wrong. I apologize for that. Open the doors.
Thank you. Go ahead, Jeff. Sorry.
Thank you. So in Ada's statutes, under the policy signing and finding section, this section is mentioned, and we've been sharing it because it's important to our project here. So it says, it is declared to be the policy of the state in the interest of promoting the health, security, and general welfare of all the people of the state and a public purpose to increase job opportunities and to otherwise to encourage the economic growth of the state, including the development of its natural resources. And so the project, the AMLA project, fits right in line with some of the findings when we were created. And one of the things that we've been sharing all along is that since 1985, Ada has a Red Dog model that we can kind of glean from. We can look through all the agreements that are in place to be able to model the AMLA project the same way. And so when you look at the AMLA Road, I mean the DMTS, $180 million was the original investment of Ada, in which they had a contract with Cominco, which is now Teck, for a 50-year lease at a 6.5% interest rate of return. So to take that into perspective, when Red Dog was founded, you have a single mine with a single commodity. And at that time, if you look at Cominco's financial statements, they were losing money every year. Ada invested $180 million to help the Red Dog mine be successful. Actually, the state helped capitalize Ada to make that investment.
Yeah, the legislature put the money in. And so, and then, because Ada has the ability to be patient, as soon as the construction was completed in 1990 of that, the zinc prices tumbled or started decreasing, and they started looking, how can we increase our revenues and make this thing sustainable? And that's why we have the $85 million worth of expansion in there, which proved to be, you know, a great idea for being able to make sure that they have enough zinc to sell to cover our bases.
So Cameco was losing money when the state financed us originally?
Yes.
Why the hell did we ever finance it if they were losing money?
Well, when you look at the agreement...
Talk to Willie Hensley.
this was a side deal?
You know, when you actually look at the $103 million initial bond issuance, it was $103 million worth of revenue bonds. So the state of Alaska nor Ada put their full faith and credit to back the revenue bonds. So the first bond issuance was revenue bonds based upon Cominco's guarantees.
Yeah, but what guarantee? What good is their guarantee if they're losing money for several years?
They pretty much did a lot of bond insurance. They had a lot of standby letters of credit and also letters of credit. They had a tune of about $200 million worth of letters of credit to back it. That's what made bondholders comfortable buying that debt.
Were they losing money globally or just in this investment? Because I don't think they were losing money globally.
When you look at the financial statements in the actual 1987 bond issuance, it doesn't break down where they were losing money. It just shows that the last 2 years of their profit and loss, they were basically negative.
Okay.
So these are the only slides I have in regards to the Red Dog Mine. And so if you have any, I'm sure the board is pretty familiar with it. So,
I'm sorry, do we maintain this road, or is this Tech maintained as part of the deal?
So our agreement with Tech is that they, well, we, our agreement is that we'll operate and maintain it, but they basically do a lot of the operation and maintenance on the road. So because we own the 52-mile road in port, they staff it and they actually maintain it and pay for all the upgrades and maintenance.
So maybe Tom will agree with me on this. My memory serves me right. About this time, Bernie, price oil was basically 9, 10, 12 bucks a barrel. We'd just gone through the early 80s of a boom and a big downturn, similar to now, maybe not as long. And Western Alaska, Northwest Alaska is looking for something. So the conditions of the day, encouraged that something happened.
Program.
Yeah.
All right.
Is that about right, Tom?
Yeah, my recollection too.
Yeah. So all I know is I was there when we hit the barges to build that road.
Great. So a little bit about the project history. And so in 1968, Nana was able to share with me this little article they found that showed that bornite was discovered. And Kennecott was pursuing developing bornite in 1968. So there was excitement happening in 1968. And then that middle map is when Anilco passed in 1980. And when you look at that map and you see all those gray areas or the little colored areas, that's basically all the federal lands that was locked up when Anilco was passed. And then on the 1981, after the patches on the right side, you can see that based upon language in Anilco, that the state started getting to work on trying to access the Ambler Mining District. So here's a study, which is pretty much almost on point with the route that Ada has selected for this project. Any questions on this slide? Okay. Here's the actual provision in Anilco that states that Congress finds that there is a need for access for the surface transportation purposes across the western Kobuk River unit of the Gates of the Arctic National Preserve from the Ambler Mining District to the Alaska Pipeline Haul Road, and the secretaries shall permit such access in accordance with this provision of this subsection. So Anilco is very special in the fact that not only did it create the 1002, which is ANWR, but it also has a special provision to provide access for the Ambler Mining District in Congress. And this is our route.
It's a 211-mile route from the Dalton Highway at mile 161. It crosses five landowners, about 61% on state land, 24% native corporation land, and 15% federal land, or federal managed land, I should say. So as you can see in that red box on the left, on the west side there, that's kind of what we coined the Ambler Mining District. And you see a lot of stars and red stars. So the red stars are the main deposits, Sun, Bornite, Arctic, and Smuckers. And so those have been explored. There's some kind of resource evaluation that's been given that shows that there's a district. But that whole area stretch is about 75 miles long. So it's about the equivalent from going to Nikiski to Homer or from Anchorage to Willow.
Jeff, is it possible to have this slide emailed to me just in print as well in the handout? And I like this slide.
Yes. And the gates of the Arctic National Preserve is right in the middle. And that's why you actually see there's actually two routes. Route A, which is the yellow, and Route B is the southern route that the BLM is analyzing right now for alternatives. So here's the actual mining district that I mentioned that's 75 miles long. It's quite impressive. And so when you look at the land holdings, that solid line is, I believe, an agreement between Trilogy and NANA to develop that. Actually, no, that's the mining district. There's a certain section that's highlighted in the orange, not orange, but the black area is where Trilogy actually has deposits, correct?
Yeah, I can speak to
that. Yeah, please speak to this.
Do you want to introduce myself or for the record? Or?
At least first, yeah.
So my name is Rick Van Nieuwenhuizen with Trilogy Metals. I'm a senior advisor to Trilogy.
So Rick, before we start,
yeah.
Are all those mines one company?
No.
But
there,
can you tell us who the companies are involved?
So actually, Rick could probably explain a lot of the companies as well, but Arctic and Bornite. So Arctic is owned by Trilogy. Bornite is owned by NANA. And so that's part of the challenge with this project is with Red Dog, the Red Dog was under NANA-owned land. And so the income generation from the natural resources underneath Red Dog gets shared, 70% of that revenue gets shared with the rest of the 7I and 7J payments with the ANCSA corporations. NANA bought Bornite from Kennecott. And basically, it's a federally patented mining claim. So NANA owns Bornite, Arctic is owned by Trilogy, and I can't explain the agreement, but NANA and Trilogy have some kind of agreement. Sun is owned by Valhalla.
Valhalla.
Valhalla. And
where are they from?
They're Alaska-owned.
Alaska-owned. And then
a private corporation owned by four or five Alaskans.
Mining company?
Exploration.
They got any money, or is it just a newbie?
No, they have money. They have access to money. They flew a geophysical survey over the project this year, so they have a good, modern, state-of-the-art, it's called VTEM, survey over the area.
Okay. So, and then you see all those little smaller stars. Some of the stars had done some exploration, but not enough exploration to be able to create an NI 43-101 that investors can kind of have an understanding of what the actual reserve or mineral resources that's in the ground. So, and then if you look here, Kobuk is already connected to Bornite. There's actually a road, an existing road that goes from Kobuk to Bornite. And that was put in when Kennecott was actually exploring and trying to produce from Bornite sometime in the 70s. Okay, next slide. So the four deposits that was highlighted in the last screen, these are some of the information that we gleaned from their NI 43-101. And that's, so Arctic is the most advanced of the group. And they have a 12-year mine life in their pre-feasibility study. And they've identified about 43 million metric tons of resources at about 4.36 copper equivalent grade. But when you look at the annual projected revenues of $866 million with a 12-year mine life. That resource is estimated to be about $10 billion.
Okay, so I'm just looking at all that, and you don't have to go through all the
sure.
numbers, Jeff. But the first thing that comes to mind is if you're getting revenue bonds to finance this road and you got a 21-year mine life, explain to me how that works.
So similar to DMTS, when DMTS was issued, Cominco had
the Long Mountain Transportation
Red Dog. My apologies. So the Long Mountain Transportation System, when they financed that and Cominco guaranteed the full 50 years, so they had a 50-year agreement in place. And even though Cominco at that time was losing funds, they did have a lot of assets. So it was just basically due to commodity prices. In this case, we would probably want to have an investor that's creditworthy that can basically guarantee a 50-year term, if that's indeed what we're trying to model after the AMLA road. So we would have to have somebody who has the balance sheet and creditworthiness to basically guarantee a 50-year term lease like DMTS.
Is that public knowledge, Rick?
Yeah. So we have a business partnership with a group called South 32. South 32 is a major Australian company. They seem to have an influx of Australians into the mining space in Alaska here over the last 2 or 3 years.
And oil,
that's right. So South 32 is a spinoff of BHP, which is the largest mining company in the world. That was about 4 or 5 years ago. They have about a $15 billion U.S. market cap. They're diversified. They produce aluminum, nickel, zinc. They're the largest manganese producer in the world. A little bit of coal. Although they're selling. I think they're selling that over the longer term. They don't produce copper, and they desperately want to produce copper. So they formed a partnership with us. We are literally in the process right now of forming a joint venture, which will be a 50-50 joint venture between Trilogy Metals. And South 32, and they do that by exercising a right to form a 50-50 by putting $150 million in the joint bank account. So we're literally in the process of doing that. I expect by the middle of January we'll be a joint venture. We'll be operating as a joint venture.
So Rick, you were the president and CEO, weren't you? And what happened? Did you get demoted, or what happened?
It's called retirement, Bernie.
you're still the face of them, right?
There's some other things I want to do in Alaska. So in order not to sort of get tripped up, I decided this was an opportune time for me to step down. And the company's transitioning, as I just said, to a joint venture. South 32 is a big company. We're going to operate like a big company. That's not really my scene. So,
president and CEO now.
Jim Gowans, and Jim is very familiar with Red Dog and the DMTS and all the things we've been talking about, because he was with Cominco when Red Dog was built. In fact, he was on the feasibility study team, and he was on the construction team, and he was the GM for the first 2 or 3 years. I think it was at least 2 years. I think.
Are you committed to stay on until they get the roads built and get through development here?
Yeah, I'll stay on it as an advisor. I'm the largest individual shareholder in Trilogy, so I definitely have a vested interest in making sure this works right. I just have some other things I want to do in Alaska, and as I said, I don't want to sort of get tripped up with having conflicts of interest. So,
okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I wanted to highlight is that the AMLA Mining District has multiple resources. So it's not just based on zinc as DMTS was. So there's copper, there's zinc, there's gold, there's cobalt, there's silver, and I'm not sure, but there's multiple commodities as compared to just a single source of commodity with Red Dog.
So is it a complex ore all found in the same ore body? Is it a complex ore?
Yes and no. I mean, what we expect to produce, so these are called polymetallic deposits. If you've ever watched the program Nova or Discovery Channel, and they're talking about submarine hot springs, black smokers, white smokers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's what these were 350 million years ago. They got smushed up on becoming part of Alaska. And so now they're basically fairly thin sheets, up to 100 feet thick. But they're sort of pancake-like ore bodies, very high grade. And that's what distinguishes them from your average copper deposit. They're basically about 10 times the grade of the average copper deposit being mined in open pits today. So very high quality. The ores, they're not complex in that there's anything special you have to do to them and from a processing standpoint. But we will be producing from Arctic a copper concentrate. It'll have a little bit of silver with it, payable silver. A zinc concentrate that's pretty much the zinc, and then a precious metal concentrate that's gold, silver, and lead in terms of the order of value.
And it'll all be shipped out of state in as a commodity, or is it going to be processed in Alaska?
No.
Finished product?
Yeah, no, we don't have any smelters, actually not in Alaska, but also not in this country anymore that have any capacities. So these concentrate products will be loaded into container boxes. They're about the same footprint as a sea can, but they have a lid on the top. They're sealed so that the metal dust doesn't leak out. This has been an issue at Red Dog over the years, and so this is why we're using these metal boxes to transfer the concentrate. It's a long journey. It's over 800 miles by truck and rail down to the port of Alaska here, where they can then be directly loaded into the ship, the bulk container ships. A special unit called the Rotobox takes the lid off, rotates the box into the ship hold, down into the ship hold, so you don't have any, again, you don't have any dust, any worry about contamination. The ships would then be bound most likely to Asian markets where there's ample smelting capacity in Korea, Japan, China, although we were also contacted by the largest European smelter, Aurubis, which is in Hamburg, Germany. Because they're looking for high-quality concentrates, specifically for copper. So there's a real market for high-quality concentrates. This will be a 30% copper concentrate, which is at the high end of the concentrate scale for copper, almost a 60% zinc concentrate. And then the precious metal concentrate is precious metal, so everybody wants that.
With the mines that we have here in Alaska, is there any economic sense that, is there any economic a reason why Alaska, why Ada wouldn't want to invest in a smelter in the state?
You're
let's talk about Ambler.
Yeah, you're going to be talking about on one of my favorite pet projects. But the Aleutians is the ideal place for a totally green mark meaning environmentally friendly produced copper.
We're going to have an extra, with 100% extra 30 renewable power that we don't know what to do with.
100% renewable energy down there. So it's a concept that we've been talking about for a while.
Well, you haven't talked to the right person because we're ready to roll. We're going to have power up and running in 2 years and looking for a.
Let's have a conversation. Let's have a conversation.
All right, keep going.
Sure. Sorry about that. Operating life is in years.
Correct. That's what their estimated resource equivalency of it. So, and even with DMTS was a 30-year mine life, and then they basically found more and more resources. And typically these resources, the more you explore, as the chair was mentioning earlier, you find more and more resources.
Where are you at on your exploration? What percentage done are you?
Yeah, so Arctic is at a feasibility level. We're finishing up a feasibility now. We had a pre-feasibility study we did last year. We don't see any significant changes. There'll be probably some adjustments in metal prices. The metallurgy there won't be any significant changes in metallurgy. Cost may go up a little bit. We'll see where the latest capital numbers come in. But this is a very robust project. It's a $1.4 billion net present value at an 8% discount rate. So it's not a marginal project by any stretch of the imagination. We'll have the feasibility study completed in March, and that will, on the back of that, we'll launch our permitting process for the mine. The Corps of Engineers, we only need one federal permit from the federal government, just a 404 wetlands permit from the Corps of Engineers. We've already had a substantial dialogue with them. It known to us that they don't want to start permitting the mine until the road's substantially permitted. So we're We're kind of dovetailed right now in a good situation because obviously the road's in the process of being permitted. So I think there's a good sort of finish up permitting the road and then start permitting the first mine. And as Jeff was saying, Bornite's fairly advanced. We've spent about $60 million, and that's probably after Kennecott spent about 40. I mean, those were old dollars, so those were, you know, more expensive dollars, so to speak, in today's world. It's a well-defined resource. We envision an open pit and an underground mine there, probably the same size and scale as Arctic, which is a 10,000 ton per day mill, which is very similar to Red Dog, just put things in context. There'll be two, what we would envision there is two separate milling operations because the ores are very different. They're not, you can't commingle them, we've looked at that. So you would have two separate mills. You could share a lot of infrastructure, of course. You might be able to share power. You might be able to share tailings facilities. Those are all things that we'll take a look at. But there's a open pit combined mining operation in excess of 20 years already defined at Bornite, and we're still exploring and seeing where the edges of Bornite are. So there's more work for us to officially be able to call it a reserve. Arctic we can call a reserve, no longer a resource. It's you know, we know we can make money out of it on an economically based on long-term metal prices. Bornite's probably 3 to 5 years behind Arctic in that sense.
Do you have ongoing exploration going right now? I mean, is there crews out on the job site?
Not right now. They're all, we shut down basically in September, October generally. What we did this year is we flew an airborne survey over the whole district. We did that in partnership in part with the folks at Valhalla over on the east end of the district. It was about a $2 million survey in total. It covers almost the whole 75 kilometers, miles of the district. And what it does, it's a state-of-the-art electromagnetic survey. These massive sulfides are very conductive, so they light up in a geophysical survey. With that survey, we've generated, you gather the raw data, and then you run it through a whole bunch of algorithms, and the geophysicists with their black box can tell you how many anomalies you have. So we have over 250 priority 1 anomalies and over 500 priority 2 anomalies.
You didn't use Harmon Kaiser out of BC, did you?
No. We used a group out of our Australian friends brought their favorite geophysicist up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because he does that with helicopters.
Yep. So this is it's a big, huge loop. It's about 100 feet, 120 feet in diameter. Flies underneath the helicopter. Again, this is a state-of-the-art system. It's similar to old systems, older systems that they use. It's just, you know,
same stuff Zong engineering used to do.
Similar. It's an EM loop. That's been around for years, but they just get more and more sophisticated. And what you have to do with this thing is with the helicopters fly within 100 feet of the terrain. So you're over mountainous terrain, you're flying kind of slow. But that's what gives you the high quality data. And you basically this system sees deeper. And that's a big advantage to it. And you get a three-dimensional picture, not just a thin skin two-dimensional picture.
That'll show you right where to dig.
Not quite that easy.
It's almost like a guarantee, right?
It's a lot of information, and literally with over 700 anomalies to look at, one of the issues you have is where do I start? Do I start with the biggest red dot or something else? And that'll take time. But that's exactly what you do in a mining district. You take your time and you evaluate things, you learn as you go, and you continually make improvements.
We did that at Chena. We spent $1.4 million.
I just got a picture of one of Harmon's helicopters.
Yeah.
We spent $1.4 million with Zong Engineering doing that. So it does. I mean, it does. Theirs isn't as fancy as what you're doing, but it does give you targets. Then you got a drill and you go drill it.
Okay, let's keep going.
So these are the four major ones. And then on the next slide are the, so if you go back to the last one, you know, Arctic is 40 million metric tons. We have obviously Sunshine and Horse Creek that has 20 and 10 potential million metric tons, but they haven't really been proven yet or are reserves. And so those are the pieces that exist. So it is a district. So the point of these slides is to show that what ADA is trying to access is a mining district. We're not just trying to build one mine. We're trying to build multiple mines to be able to unlock the state's natural resources.
So we drilled at Sunshine this year. First time we've drilled outside of Arctic and Bornite in the last probably 8 years. And we had grades and thicknesses about the same as what we have at Arctic. So it's about a 5% copper equivalent. So, these were new zones. They were not sort of drilling old zones and just infilling. This was new stuff. So it's incredibly prospective ground. Okay. Of course, that was known way back when. This is why Congress put that special language in the NILCA.
And that's all I have on. Do you have any other questions on the mineral resources in the district?
I just have a question to Rick. Rick, so on your spend, as far as delineating the resource, what percentage are you done? In other words, on your actual exploration program.
You go back to the Arctic slide, the Arctic Bornite slide. So it's a good question. So just to put things in perspective, we spend about $130 million in the district, and that includes the $40 million we paid to Kennecott to acquire all of their information and the Arctic patented land. About half of that we've spent at Bornite, a little less, and the other half on the Arctic and the rest of the district, including the geophysical survey that I mentioned. So what's left at Arctic in terms of exploration is when you do a feasibility study, a bankable document, the bank wants sort of a guarantee of your reserves, and they refer to that as a measured reserve. So it's another internal drilling, another layer of internal drilling, probably be about $3-4 million worth of drilling. It's something we can get done with 2-3 drill rigs in about 2 months. It's a very simple step, given that we're well established to conduct business up there. So that's the remainder of the exploration work that has to be done. The feasibility study will sort of speak for itself, and obviously, in today's world where it takes 2, 3, 4, 5 years to permit a mine, I'm hoping it's closer to the 2-3 and not the 5+. But you do a feasibility study for security purposes, but then you really need to do a feasibility study for the bank. And you're gonna do that as you're wrapping up your permitting so that you know you actually can start. So we see sort of another layer of feasibility work once we can sort of see the light at the permitting tunnel, at the end of the permitting tunnel. So that'll be probably in a couple of years' time. But the infill drilling we'll do probably next year. Like I said, it's a $3-4 million program.
And also, we've had discussions with South 32 to let them know about the DMTS model, and so they are aware that DMTS had a guarantee on it. So they're considering that as they're partnering and considering their joint venture with Trilogy.
So when you put your performa together and you have your information that the banks want as far as known reserves and quantities and whatnot, I assume we'll be privy to all that.
Yep. We're
we're
an incredibly public company, so I mean, okay. Everything we do, everything is material to us.
I'm just thinking the decision makes we have to use the board. The more information that we have, the better decision we can make. Information, good information makes good decisions. So,
what is your time frame on getting through? Would you have a time frame? Would you look at to actually break ground, be through permitting, and actually look at building something?
Yeah, so on the assumption that we can start permitting second quarter of next year, so again, predicts that the road
you kind of need the road. I would assume the road's done. It has to happen.
So I think we're planning on a 2-3 year permitting timeline. We only need one federal permit.
And you'll start that as we're finishing up on the road here at the same, there'll be parallel paths?
Yeah, we hope to start permitting in second quarter of next year.
Perfect.
So, if it takes 3 years.
We hope the road's built by then. We're done with it.
That might be optimistic.
Well, we're going to push along here a little bit.
But so it'd be, let's say it's 3 years to permit. Let's be a little on the conservative side. It's going to take 3 years to achieve commercial production, 3 years of construction to achieve commercial production. And again, that's on the assumption that there's a road at that, by that time, that there's at least a Pioneer road built.
So you're looking at a 6 year time frame to be actually doing something. I mean,
making money.
Making ground, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, next, Jeff. We're on a little time constraint here already, so.
All right, well, I'll cruise through the rest of these. Some of the economic impacts to the state as far as jobs. So we're looking at about 2,700 direct jobs and operations about 500 annually with the operations of the four mines. And the state, about $1.3 billion worth of government income, either from payment in lieu of taxes to the Northwest Iowa Borough, as well as state mining taxes and corporate taxes. So, as we mentioned,
did you do that state revenue estimate yourself, or was that done through the tax department, or where did that come from?
Those figures came from the Center of Economic Development Economic Impact Study. So we have that done as of 2018. So we, Nolan's group from the University of Alaska Anchorage conducted that, and that's where those figures come from.
Thank you.
So it's a complex project. We have 29 bridge crossings, 12 million cubic yards of fill, about 40 fish passage sites, caribou concern considerations. We have ANILCA and NEPA requirements. Overall, we have about 26 permits and authorizations that the project has to go through. And so we are, and a lot of federal laws. So those are all the federal laws. I put an acronym in the back so that you guys can look at all the federal laws that we have to follow. So next slide. Here's another listing of all the permits that we have to get for this project and a description of what those permits are. Next slide. What is NEPA? So at our last board meeting, there was some concern of a potential litigation, and it comes through the NEPA process that those litigation may come through. And so NEPA is kind of, this is a high-level overview of what NEPA is, which is what we're going through right now with the Bureau of Land Management taking the lead on. It's one of the first laws that protect and enhance the environment. NEPA considers many aspects, and so the draft EIS was over 100 pages with a lot of supporting documentation, so it's four volumes that are in there when it comes to different reports and studies. But overall, they looked at all these pieces, subsistence, socioeconomics, public health, air quality, climate change, environmental justice, soil vegetation. One of the things you won't see here is when it comes to financial feasibility. So a lot of pieces in NEPA, NEPA doesn't have to consider financial feasibility, but a lot of comments from the public have been on financial feasibility, and we're going to address those here in a little bit. So NEPA's impact on project, as Rick mentioned, it takes time to conduct an EIS. And so it takes between 4 to 6 years. But in Alaska, it takes sometimes longer because we don't have the data. We have a lot of greenfields that the federal government doesn't have LIDAR. They don't have mapping. So we're working with raw data that it's not quite detailed enough. So when we're looking at analyzing, especially a 200-mile alternative, most of that is unknown, and that's part of the reason why we have, as we talk about the budget full on, is we have to go and do some field work after we get to a record of decision. So from a litigation standpoint,
talk about all that stuff.
Sure.
Okay. That's nauseam about
permitting
all that. We actually want to talk about the road.
Finance. Perfect.
Okay, so so let's talk a little bit about the road.
All right, we'll skip through here.
The board doesn't mind.
So
I'm going to start off with the first question.
Sure.
First question is, who do you deal with as far as cutting a deal with operating the road? Do you have a consortium? Who
Who, what, when, and where? Who's the group? Is it One Mind, Three Minds, all those people you showed us? Who does ADA negotiate with to come up with a 50-year program to go out and finance and put a 211-mile road in?
So we've talked to our PFM to put together some projections for us as far as being able to bond this project.
No, no, no. Who are you talking to?
So
are you talking to Rick's company and all of them? Have you guys formed a consortium? That's first and foremost. Who's
in charge?
Yeah, who are you talking to? I don't need a financial person to tell us. What I want to know is who the people are. You know, we have a consortium that deals with Bradley Lake and whatnot. So someone's going to have to step up to the plate and say, we're going to pay this back over time at a certain rate, right? I mean, cutting the chase. Who is that?
Sorry.
So for the record, my name is Mark Davis on this project too. So I focus a lot on that. So we'll create a LLC to operate the road. We have been in discussions, which we can go through at executive session, with various parties that would probably join in that investment with us, and we'd hire an operator to operate the road.
It's not the investment. I'm talking about who to use the road. Okay.
Who's going to use?
I'm not worried about the money right now. I'm worried about who's going to use the road and what is the group? Are you going to do single agreements per mining? Are you going to force them to come to a joint service agreement for the whole, the use of the road? Who's the guarantee?
Who's
going to
be responsible?
So
paying the tolls, guys.
Who's the responsible party?
Pay the tolls. I want to pay the tolls. So
I think that's something that has to be negotiated because this is envisioned as a multiple use
we don't
road
in
terms
somebody
of
that wants to pay him. It's going to be hard to get this road.
So for the record,
we spent $26 million. Yeah. And you just got another $700,000. I want to know who in the heck, I'll use the word heck, Bernie. Who in the heck, what entity are you dealing with to actually put the thing together and make it work? Not who's going to invest in the road, because they're going to ask the same question as we as investors. Who's using it and who's going to pay the tolls? That's what I want to know. Who is it?
Each mine user would pay a toll. It's probably
what you're telling me is that there is no group that's put together.
Is that right?
Has there been a group to put together?
No, there's no group. Right now, Trilogy is the only one spending money on exploration. So we would be the ones, we're ready to do something. But we need to
have. So the question I have is, if you're prepared to negotiate a $400 or $500 million spend on a road over a 50-year deal and guarantee that gets paid back.
Yeah. Now I'll say that I think what's more realistic is when we have our joint venture with South 32. I think now you're talking about the joint venture company, which will probably be
But your company's taking the lead on it. So what happens when another company comes in? Do they deal with you, and you come up with a tolling agreement with them, and you're guaranteeing?
I think that's part of the discussion that we envision having with ADA once there's a road to be built. There's probably a whole year to 2 years worth of work to come to agreements with the landowners. The BLM record decision only gives you a right-of-way across BLM lands. You still got to go out and get agreements with the state, Department of Natural Resources, with NANA, with Doyon.
Mm-hmm. So we've got a record.
While that's going
hopefully in 3 or 6 months or whatever it is, we've got this thing. All right, so that clock has stopped, and now we've got a new clock and a new spend, whatever those dollars are.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Yep. I want to ask you guys, are you guys going to come to us and ask us to spend more money without an agreement with the ultimate users?
I think we'll ask you for funds to negotiate. As Mr. Van Nieuwen has said, it's going to take negotiations between
2 years worth of negotiations.
I do know I was going to say something.
How can you tell?
I can tell. when he said negotiation, you got 2 years. I'm a little surprised actually that the state has invested $26 million and more to get to something, and there is not a ongoing sidebar with an agreement in principle, subject to cost, right? in terms and subject to whatever the EIS comes out with, that there's something in place already, ready to, so that there is no, you know, you're not asking this board on good faith to put a bunch of money up to continue the process without an agreement with the end user. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and we're willing to sit down and have that initiate that discussion. I don't think that's going to take 2 years. I think there's a lot of other things that have to happen here that I'm hoping it doesn't take 2 years. I hope it takes a year, but it's going to take a year. It's not going to happen overnight.
I can tell you that if we don't have that commitment, who's going to pay for the road? You know, we're not going to build it.
Yeah.
You know, simple as that. In this atmosphere with the way people are, there's a lot of people not happy with the road anyway. And so we need a commitment. I mean, Red Dog Chemical was losing money. They at least gave us a commitment. They're going to pay for it. You know, yeah. They were willing to do that.
No, and we're willing to do the same thing. And I think in a world where you have half of the debt's negative interest rate, I think this is the kind of project that makes a hell of a lot of sense. So heck of a lot of sense.
I want to just encourage, go ahead, Greg, I'm sorry.
Has your consortium, you and the Australian company, considered the prospect of building the road yourself and owning it? Keeping us out of it?
We certainly had that discussion, yeah.
Is that something you would consider future discussions on, just if it came to that?
Well, because we've got a very valuable mine here, and we think there's a whole district worth. So, yeah, I mean, okay. if Ada's not willing to do this, we'll have to look at alternatives. I think this is a good business opportunity for the state, frankly.
There's multiple users. I don't disagree with that. I just want to understand, you know, the path.
Our first path is to get a right-of-way. Without a right-of-way, everything is academic. So that's that's been the process.
The at-risk dollars, Mark, is being spent right now.
Absolutely.
Right? At risk. So, so once those dollars are spent, I want to understand what happens after that. You get the right-of-way. New dollars are going to be spent. You've got to do some preliminary engineering, some surveying, get out there. Someone's got to come up with a cost estimate to put the road in. These people have got to be comfortable with it, and they've got to say, okay, and theoretically, here's what the market's going to require on interest rates, and you guys have negotiated a rate of return. That takes money, all right? Who's going to pay for that?
Well, we're in discussions, like I said, with several groups that would invest with us for some of those funds to do those negotiations with the mine.
Yeah, well, that's the first we're hearing of that, Mark, and I don't know if that's a good thing or bad. So don't count on that being the best thing, that you're negotiating with third parties that we have no idea who you're talking to.
Well,
that has nothing to do with the bearing of what I'm trying to accomplish here, and that is the path of what has to be done, when it has to be done, who's ultimately responsible, and what funds are required.
And all Dana's asking for is an agreement with end users subject to all of these conditions being met. And I don't think that's hard for you guys to put together, and that's what we're asking you to do.
Yeah, from my perspective, it would be very helpful just to put together a Gantt chart of here are the things that have to happen and a rough timeline, of an estimated timeline of when they have to happen. And this would, this should be a core part of that.
Don't get me wrong. I think this is a great project.
Yep.
It just that we have to manage dollars, and we have to understand. Yep. And I understand the legislature, you know, originally with DOT, and now with ADA, they put up $26 million at risk without the guarantee that anything would ever happen with it as far as a successful thing. So if we're on the cusp of something successful. But there's more to the story, and there's so much more to the story. You know, there's 5 or 6 years, I think, before you even think about getting product to market if everything went right. And I'm here to tell you, there's dollars going to be spent between now and then. And I kind of want to understand the framework, not to the penny or to the, but the detail and the framework, so that I can make a good decision as a board member.
And justify doing it. Justify spending the money.
That's right.
Justify going to the legislature to get money. Justify anything.
So my other question is there any point in time on this project, subject to the deal, that we have to go back to the legislature?
I would think not.
Okay.
I mean, that's the model I'd like to use, would, that we would not do that.
Okay.
And that we will look for other sources other than ADA, too, to fund this.
Right.
But we'll have to engage with the mines. If we get the right-of-way, that's a valuable asset. It has a shelf life.
ADA can be sold. ADA funding it is really going to be, I mean, what I'm going to call it the donut hole. Between the time you get a record decision, the time that there's actually something going, there's some money got. Whether ADA funds it or not, it's about, I guess, in my world, it's about understanding and what we know the process and agreements are in place. All right. I think the agreements that are in place, you know, these folks have spent a lot of money for a very good reason, and I don't think they're going to go anywhere. And I'm comfortable if it's ADA asset to do it, but I want to make sure everything's in place. What I don't want to have happen is we come back to the bucket, and we don't have the agreements in place.
No, with
right? That's yeah. I think that's the key. And so I want to avoid that. I want to, I guess, the best.
And that's certainly what our shareholders want to see.
Yeah.
You know, we're a public company, and South Carolina 2 is a public company. They're bigger, but they have this, you know, shareholders want the same thing. They want to understand what our dollars are going for, and then that if we're entering into an agreement with an agency, a state agency, how that works.
In the EIS, the BLM asked ADA, you know, if it would be building the road without commitments, and we said no.
Right.
So, but we put that's in there. We told all the mining companies that's our position.
Yeah, I just don't want to hold up. You know, I don't want the mining companies or the people supporting this project come back and say we're dragging our feet. We haven't done this. You know, we're waiting. It puts more pressure on us. All of a sudden, now we're making decisions based on what we have to do, not what we should be doing. I just really encourage that we get out in front of it, that the agreements are put in place. Julie?
Mark, you were talking about the shelf life of the right-of-way. Can you finish that statement?
Sure. It's under the National Environmental Policy Act, Environmental Impact Statement. Most court decisions have said they're good for 5 to 8 years, the data, which means that you don't have to build the project right away. So ADA will actually own that right away. It'll be an asset. And then we need to find commitments, as the chair said, that people want to use this thing before we build it. And we've stated that publicly. It's in the EIS. Mm-hmm. And the mines are aware of that. So once we get the right, if we do get the right away, then we'll have to start negotiating and say,
while you're negotiating, I've seen this done before, just as an example, is that you say, well, we got to spend $5 million this year. We go, okay, Rick, you know, we'll put $2.5 million in, you put $2.5 million in, let's get it back, you get the money back at the end, but let's keep the project going, right? I mean, it's not about the actual signing of the document, it's an understanding to do so, but we don't want to slow it down if that's the case.
No, parallel paths. That road is just as important to Rick as it is to us.
No,
actually,
more important.
I was going to say probably are equal anyway, equal importance.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, I would just encourage that. And if you need more resources to do that, let us know.
Yeah, right. But obviously the commitments are part of the plan, and that's in the public record.
And we already have the DMTS model already envisioned, the documents already in there, envisions other users. And so we already have a template to go off of for negotiations. So
that's the end use stuff. I'm talking about
the near term. The near term.
I'm talking
about
this interim because money still has to be spent.
Correct.
There's, I'm going to call it not all at risk. We're going to call it 50 at risk dollars.
Right.
There's going to be a point in time where it's not quite as at risk as the $26 million,
right?
But it's still a little bit at risk.
Yep, absolutely.
I mean, I think I would go beyond Dana and really, as you're looking for agreements with the end users, I mean, I'd really encourage us to ask the end users to be the planners, financiers, builder of the road.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let them go find the outside financing, or let them come to ADA and ask for a loan. Because, you know, they're going to be the people who benefit primarily from the road. Of course, we'll collect taxes. They're going to be the ones who have the motivation, incentive to do it most efficiently, to find the best financing, et cetera, et cetera. Let them figure out agreements with future users who come in and how they're going to split the cost. I mean, I think that should be at least considered as an option.
I would respectfully disagree. We have a beautiful model at Red Dog Mine. It has worked flawlessly. And I think we follow a beautiful model. And that's what funds ADA.
That's right.
That's the only reason we have any money. So I would respectfully disagree. I think that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard of. We're throwing everything away. Why do that? We have a golden opportunity here.
Well, so at the end of the day, I would encourage, and hopefully with board support, that you parallel path it and make sure that you have a path forward between the record of decision between the permit,
right,
and an actual road construction that doesn't stop anything, but yet shares the risk, so to speak, somehow that we can defend. So that's
we,
and the reason, Mark, I said I don't know about third party investors and all that kind of stuff, that just adds another layer of people slowing the process down. Right? I'm a firm believer, if you're in the driver's seat, you drive the boat, you get to the finish line, then you say, well, here's the deal. If you want in, here's what it costs. But if you get a bunch of people in there with all different ideas and what their rate returns are and what their investment is, it just slows the process down and becomes problematic. I mean, that's my opinion. I think not at the front end, at the back end. So we got a model to use that's successful. We use it. If people want to invest after the fact, that, you know, once the agreements are made, great.
And we have the ability to bond it. So no matter who does this project, we say, we want you to do it, and you go find the money, you're never going to get the deal we're going to get. And you're going to be screwing around. You're going to spend the same amount of time, if you ever got the money, to build that road. And it's an asset that the state should own, because that's what works. We don't want you to own the road. I think that would be a real disservice to Alaska, real disservice to all the citizens of Alaska. Matter of fact, it would be a slap in the face to all the citizens, in my opinion.
Well, that would drive the cost up.
They're not going to be able to get the bond money we can get. That's all there is to it.
Not even the cost of money. It's the reclamation at the end of the job. When that's over with, they have to pull the road up.
We don't have to.
Not as a state deal. So they've got to now put that into the performance.
It would almost make your job, just like the pipeline, they got to take everything back up.
Right.
If that was state owned, we wouldn't take any of it up. They got to remove everything. Remove the pads, remove the right of way, they got to take everything out.
So it affects their business model. So anyway, that's my ask. Okay, I don't think it's difficult.
Yeah.
But
Rick, it's in your best interest to push these guys a little bit. It's in your best interest to have this parallel path, and push them to be parallel path, and for you to do as much work as you can on parallel with them, even now, as much as you possibly can. You need to push them.
Yeah, we'd love to enter into an MOU where we're doing just that. I think it makes sense.
Yeah, I mean,
they want to kind of wait until they get their permit.
Get the BLM record decision.
Yeah, that, there's a reason for that.
Keep in mind, you still have the 404.
Yeah. We'll discuss that in executive session.
That's why I'm here, Bernie.
And a lot of the investors that are interested are actually boroughs. So the North Slope Borough and the Northwest Arden Borough has passed resolution
right now.
So,
okay.
Yeah. So the draft EIS, some of the main concerns that we heard from the community members and the villages were centered around basically food insecurity. Many of the villages basically survive off of subsistence hunting and fishing. And so when you get 70% of your food supply from those resources, they're really concerned when the Bureau of Land Management comes out to their communities and says that the project may significantly impact their subsistence. And ADA basically disagrees with the assumptions and that conclusion that BLM arrived at.
BLM's actually telling them that?
Yes.
Okay, so we got 5 minutes left.
Okay, I'll skip. That's an overview of the thing, and then the financial feasibility concerns. But We disagree with a lot of the findings in the EIS because the assumptions were based upon ADA building a road that was not designed properly, that was not permitted properly when it comes to culverts and bridges, which we know that Alaska Department of Fish and Game, DC, there's no way that ADA would build something that is not by law. And so their assumptions are flawed, and that's how they came about that, yeah, if you don't maintain a road, you're going to impact the fish. So those were ADA's comments on the draft EIS, and I'll move forward, and you guys can read through this later.
Yeah,
This is an example of one of the pieces that they're afraid that caribou would be impacted. When you look at their actual draft EIS, 0.005% of the actual Western Arctic caribou herd will be impacted by our project. But they're saying that we're going to impact the caribou. Here's DMTS. We have caribou, thousands of caribou across the DMTS every year. There's the mine. There's thousands of caribou hanging around the Red Dog Mine.
How many trucks are driving that every day?
We have about 50 trucks every day traveling the DMTS.
And what's the assumption on this mine? How many trucks a day?
40 back and forth. So if you stand in one spot,
about
you'll
the
see
same.
You.
They're 50 there. Close. Pretty close. About the same tonnage you were saying.
Same.
So, you know, we definitely disagree with the draft EIS, and we hope that the BLM corrects it, and then the communities will feel a little more secure that our road is not going to kill the fish, we're not going to kill the caribou, they can coexist. Why ADA took over, I'm not going to go through this, it's because we have the abilities and powers granted by legislature. Access, so there are two pieces, because they're concerned about food security, is they're afraid that they're competing with the private hunters or fishermen. So that's why they wanted the road to be private versus public. So they wanted to keep it private, and that's what ADA has the ability to do, is to keep it private. I'm going to go through all these. We're not the same as the Dalton. We're going to have many agreements in place to keep the road private. With the Dalton Highway, the department, the commissioner of DOT, at any time can close any freeway or highway in the state. He has the authority. Our agreements are going to keep the road private. We're going to have follow the same procedures as DMTS. With DMTS, when caribous are starting to cross, that road closed down for several days until all the caribou crosses.
So I'm going to give you a theoretical scenario. It's 50 years down the line. They've got more mining stuff going. Price of oil is $200 a barrel. It's costing the communities out there in space heat and whatnot astronomical. And finally someone says, you know, we've got this transportation corridor that will cut our space heat and our cost of living in half if we just use it. Is there ability to do that?
Yes.
Yes. For the communities. Absolutely.
It's a little complicated. The legal answer is yes, and it's been done once before in Alaska when a road that was going to be reclaimed was not reclaimed at the request of local residents.
Where was that?
That's part of the Pogo Mine Road, which is part of it's being shut down, and they're going to keep part of it open. That's part of the NEPA process, so even though NEPA requires reclamation, it also allows for a change at the end of the project.
Okay.
Thank you. So I'm going to move forward with the funding and pass forward. So this is a slide that is on most of our newsletters that ADA publishes and provides to the public. All we did is just break down the road pathway into stages. So stage one was kind of reconnaissance studies that DOT looked at. Stage two is us basically applying for the SF-299 application and started the federal permitting process. Stage three is kind of we labeled this stage three, where the draft EIS is complete and we're waiting on a record of decision. Stage four is when we start actually looking and getting additional field work, or we'll call it front-end engineering design and field work, to be able to start designing the bridges, the road, and collecting all the data. And entering, there's multiple paths here that we're going to be doing concurrently. So we've assigned a budget to each one of those stages. And so stage one, 9.25 came from DOT, and 8.5 came from ADA. And that took about 5 years for the reconnaissance level and pre-application. Stage two, our application, we've been doing the application process for the past 4 years, and that's about $8.5 million. So we've actually spent that whole $8.5 million as of last month. Stage three is where we're at right now, and at our last board meeting, we estimated a total of $1.5 million, and we'll break this down a little bit later. Stage four, we broke up the field work and permitting because that's kind of some cost. You have to kind of do all out of the field work, but there's no really quantifiable, you know, something you can hold in your design, so we put stage five as design. So these are the estimated costs, and from the funding source, that's what Mark was mentioning, is we have been approached by some the Northwest Arbor Borough that says, hey, we want to put money into stages four or five.
All right, that's fine and dandy, yeah. But there's no people there in the mining. That shouldn't be investors. That should be that field work, design, and whatnot. You should be dealing with the people that are ultimately going to use the road.
Okay.
Not an investor. The people that are you know, design, all that, the right of ways, all that should be done with the people that are going to pay your bills.
Correct. Okay. So, and the time frame for each one of those is conservative at 4 years apiece. If you do it concurrently, you need at least 1 year's worth of field work to start designing. So, and technically, if you expedite everything, you get up to 5 years from the time of a rod to get to a final design and final feasibility package that we can present to the board and say, hey, this is, and we'll have hopefully agreements in place by then. We'll have to have agreements in place by then to be able to say, hey, here's who's going to pay for it. Here's their creditworthiness. Here's all the incentives and credit backstops that they're going to have to be able to, for us to bond it. So we just, the total construction cost right now is about, $449 million is the actual construction to phase two. Because we're basically stating that when we build it, the first stage is the Pioneer Road, and then that's going to take 2 years. And then 2 years additional to build out phase two, which is the all-season one-lane road, which is 20 foot wide. And so.
Is that a 10%?
At a 10% design. This is conservative. And when we looked at, it's about a $1.5 million per mile estimate when you look at the overall scheme of things. And when Tanana was built, the road to Tanana, that cost about $500,000. So we're almost three times what it costs to build a similar road in the region. And so when it comes to financing, there's some reserve accounts that we wanted to set up. So there's about $50 million worth of reserve accounts to cover any debt service coverage needed if something happens in the future. And then, as you mentioned, reclamation costs, $75 million to reclaim the road. And there's a fear that if the project is built and is not maintained, then you got to pull it out. So that's part of the projected cost right now. And then annual operation maintenance, which is not included in that $661 million, is to maintain the road.
Have you had any problems getting access to your right-of-ways on private lands to do your field work, like primarily Doyon or Nalan?
So most of the field work that has been done so far has been on federal land. So when we filed our SF-299 application, we actually sent out to five different federal agencies applications for a right-of-way and permit. And so the National Park Service, because they were conducting a non-NEPA, which is an environmental and economic analysis per ANILCA, we had to do a lot of field studies and field work along the National Park and Preserve. So most of the field work has been concentrated in federal lands. And so there hasn't been a lot of access or field work that's been done on private land.
So you haven't done any yet?
I'll have to defer that to Dal.
I'm just curious. Yeah. If you're running into difficulties getting access to the private land.
Well, and we've had discussions that if the board decides to fund us for these field work and permitting stages, then we will, we're in discussions that we'll have to get access and permits for those. So that's our kind of our estimate for the project as from phase one to phase two. This doesn't include a phase three, which is a two-lane, similar type of road for as the MTS.
Okay.
Okay. Any questions here?
I had a question on a previous
slide.
Sure. So you know, on the state and local payments that's from the UAA study,
yes.
You know, that $1.3 billion, do you know over what time frame that was estimated?
That's over the life of the mines.
50 years?
No. 30. About 21 to 30, yeah.
21 to 30.
We think that's going to expand as you find more resources. And all right. So, and for the board, this is kind of just a breakdown of all the work that was spent. And so I won't go through all these since Dana's shaking his head. So, but this is something that...
Killed us yesterday's board meeting.
So the board approved G1921 of $718,000, and I had to, you know, in order for me to have this presentation to the board, I had to have this ready 2.5 weeks ago. So a lot of these things are still correct, but we're starting to have discussions with the federal agencies that we may not even need the additional $782,000. I actually think the $718,000 that we projected back in October is sufficient to get us possibly through a rod. But
good luck.
we're knocking on wood, but discussions with the federal agencies have been good, and so we may not need to come to the board for another ask. So, and then here's stage four, and we can go into more detail if you want, but it sounds like we just want to cruise through here.
The beautiful speed, keep going.
Yeah. So, you know,
how fast do I should build it?
Our presentation. So, if you have any further questions or want to get into specifics, the staff would be more than willing to answer any of your questions.
Okay. So, questions?
More for later.
I just like to make the comment that, especially when there's multiple end users for an asset like a road or any transportation corridor, it's my opinion and what I've been told and based on my historical background with being up here my whole life, is government has a role to play, and the role to play is to open up access so the private industry can prosper and create jobs and wealth for whatever political subdivision you're in. So we're here we are in Alaska. Well, you know, what's really important, I think, is that when we focus about why the Ambler project is important and the road is important, if you think about the rates of returns on investment that people expect with their dollars on the private side, it's typically north of 10% on risk. So Rick's over here, he's got his mining companies, and they want to put all their money into the mine, right? But risk associated with a big mine. Well, I just saw it looks like there's some little mines there, and those little mines they can't throw big dollars at the infrastructure and expect 6.5% rate of return or 4%. They won't get any money because it's risk. So we're actually helping to promote, you know, more than just one big 800-pound gorilla,
right,
by having multiple users on the road. And I think that's ADA's mission.
Yes.
I think that's our function to help facilitate that. I appreciate Rick and the 800-pound gorilla. You know, that's great. We got to have one to start with.
Yep.
But in reality, I want the board to think about, you know, that this affords opportunities for things that we don't even know about that, you know, maybe small Alaska companies can go out there and make a go of it. And we're fortunate to have an anchor tenant, but it's no different than the oil business. They want to put their money in downhole to get the product out, and they need help, you know, in the transportation. That's a government service. Bernie?
There's only two ways to create wealth. You either mine it or you grow it. There's no other way. All the rest is all bullshit. There's no other way to do it. The other stuff. You either mine it or you grow it. The old Chinese proverb is the best time to plant a tree was 30 years ago. The second best time's today. So I don't know why it's taken us so long to get this road permitted. It just drives me nuts. This road, as far as I'm concerned, is a no-brainer. The only way that we can ever, ever, ever create wealth for the state of Alaska and for its citizens is by building infrastructure. And that is government's job, to build infrastructure. And have it for everyone. Just like Dana said, for the little guy, it's nice to have the big gorilla. Don't get me wrong. We want you there.
We need you.
But we would like all the little baby gorillas too.
I have a question.
The little bitty ones.
Who are the leaseholders in all this area? It's not just one big 800-pound gorillas?
No.
There's multiple.
In response, so the idea of the right-of-way is it would be owned by ADA, and that BLM would issue that right-of-way in the EIS to...
No, I realize that.
And so
we should own the road, too.
The state agency controls it. It doesn't have to own it. It controls it through the right-of-way. But, I mean, it's important.
We have a model at Red Dog Mine that I'm telling you guys, it's flawless. I keep going back to it. I hate to keep bringing it up, but it is a flawless model that we should be emulating.
Right. But remember, we did revenue bonds, so even though we technically own it, we didn't technically finance it. So
that's okay.
But we own it. So that's what I mean. There's a structure here where we'll own the right of way. We'll own the state agency will own the road.
Yeah. The financial conditions of the day will dictate how it's done. And that's to be determined. I just encourage you to have something in place so that the decisions we make and the economic commitments we have confidence that we're it's not all at risk dollars.
And parallel paths.
We'll get started with that as soon as we get to the record, and we'll start discussion.
Just on your comment, Board Chair, the Amber Mining District, this road is going to access the Amber Mining District, but if you look at the map, this half of the road, it's all state land. And Doyon land. So
there's a lot of resources
with opportunities we don't
exploration done out there because it's too bloody expensive. This road will make it a lot less expensive to explore a huge swath of state land that hasn't had anything done on it in period. Hasn't had any exploration, any modern exploration.
Thanks for mentioning that because I wasn't aware of that. So thank you for that.
That's the off the map part, is it?
Well, it's between the Hall Road and Ambler.
It's about 210 miles.
There's a lot of area. There's 180 miles that's the future opportunity that no one knows yet.
Right. And when you look at the USGS, and there's a map on our AmblerAccess.org website, it shows, it lights up, you know, copper, gold, rare earths. We have it on our front page because we want the state to recognize that there's mineral resources, not just in the district, but along the Southern Brooks Range.
Hasn't all been explored yet, right?
Not
at all. And you would even consider exploring more of it if you had a nice, easy road, wouldn't you? I mean,
yeah, now that I'm retired, I might think about doing something like that.
Okay. So let's thank you. Appreciate the great proposal. Thank you for coming. Take a quick 5-minute break, and then we have a collaboration opportunity to talk about.
I think what the state should do is buy a bunch of their stock.
As long as we put a mute while they're on break. You are on the record.
So, I asked this topic to be put on our agenda. An overview, just kind of a discussion overview of the collaboration opportunities between both ADA and AEA. We've heard some very good news about how the two organizations are working better with each other and getting stuff done when it comes to shared services, the facilities, whatnot. I want to take that to the next level. How can AEA help ADA or ADA help AEA in the missions that they do, in the overlap? Is there stuff out there that comes along? I'd like the board to kind of understand if a project comes in, does AEA consider ADA, or if ADA sees something, does ADA consider AEA? Mm-hmm. You know, what one of the things that I do know that's happening is that, you know, on the AEA, managed or been leads on some ADA projects because of their expertise in energy. And really, I want to kind of set a framework to visit with you guys about rural Alaska especially, and when all else fails, you know, how do we help folks that are responsible and prudent and trying to do the right thing if there's an investment opportunity or finance opportunity. So that's kind of my mission. That's why I brought it up, and I've asked Curtis to attend with us.
Well, I'll just take a stab at it real quick. I think the first thing is when we receive ADA or ADA, AEA or ADA, I think we both look at the opportunities and who best is suited for it. You know, case in point, Snetisham Dam is owned by ADA. It's managed by AEA. On the flip side, we have Sam Tappan, who used to work for AEA doing as an economist, now works for ADA, and he actually serves on our loan committee for our PPF loan fund. And we share him. Betsy McGregor, who was the environmental coordinator for SUWA, she's been helping on the AMBA road almost 50% of her time. So we share those staffs, and we charge into those different accounts, too. So if Betsy's working on AMBLER, she charges into AMBLER. Sam's working on something for AEA, looking at a prospectus, then he charges into our time. So as far as employees go, and as far as those projects, I think we're pretty good. And I think, you know, the same thing as we had talked about the S&Q line. One of the things that we looked at immediately was if we can't do it, because we're not in the business of buying assets, AEA isn't. We have been given assets and we own assets, but it might be an opportunity for ADA to help finance that line with the utilities participating, with AEA having the project, but you guys being the financiers of the project. So I think between it, our management teams work very closely together, back and forth on all kinds of projects. We had somebody come in yesterday talking about different projects. We looked at the list and said, we can help you here, here, and here, and we'll put you in contact with ADA here, here, and here. And so we do that across. We've met with Alan several times as he brings groups in, and as it has had issues before AEA, we've met with them.
So Curtis, along those lines, when you go out to the communities, do you tell the customer or the potential that not only are you entity of the energy company, but you also bring a financial component with you that may be able to help them out as far as financing a project?
Thank
you. Which on the ADA side. So is there a boilerplate? So if I'm out of Anchorage someplace and I've got an energy, I'm a cold bay,
mm-hmm.
and I'm a for-profit utility, which they are, and I want to upgrade, and I need $5 million to upgrade, do you have, can I ask you, well, what kind of interest rate you can charge and what's the term?
Yeah, through our PPF, our Power Project Fund, I can answer that.
Okay, no.
But in addition to that, if it's beyond ours, then I send them to ADA.
One option is that fund. Right. And I guess what I'm thinking about is that fund's only got so much money in it.
Right.
Okay. And really the frontline people will kind of guide the project to who should fund it.
Mm-hmm.
An example would be if you have a utility that has the wherewithal and the resources and the cash flows, you can spend a little bit more money, you would say, well, let's let ADA finance that, mm-hmm. have them finance it. So we preserve any grant dollars or any power funds, the folks that are more marginal and don't quite have the wherewithal, and that we can give them a better deal. I mean, you're really selecting now.
Right.
You're really making an economic determination. But at the end of the day, you're servicing everybody that you can. Do you guys do that?
We do.
I advocate on behalf of ADA when I go out and I talk, if there's, and especially people come with us, with projects that need financing, I turn it over to ADA.
I haven't seen it. What energy project?
Well,
do we see it at the board?
Well, no.
Have you seen one?
No. They have.
Have we had any?
That's the thing. What crosses that threshold?
Please remember your
chips plugs
make a lot of noise.
They're all open right now.
Well, I'd like to add to that. Our department, Community and Regional Affairs, and our department is trying to work closely with AEA as well and ADA to make sure that not only their programs, because we all do the rural outreach piece. So ideally, you know, we're still in the planning phase, but we could travel together and address community issues, one from the energy perspective, others from the support that's provided through not only DCRA, but Commerce has different loan funds, ADA has different loan funds, so there's, mm-hmm. we need to build a package for rural Alaska that,
that's a tool.
Yeah, that we can say, here we are, this is the way you go for what and how you do it.
You know, and this is, one thing to keep in mind is When we're in rural Alaska and people look for us, some of what they want, they're looking more for a grant you give them the financing opportunities and tools, and they don't qualify, or that's not what they're looking for, and they drop it right there.
Well, I'm going to come clean with you. I'm thinking that you may get some really interesting information on the survey that you do. And if we have some ideas, if we have some policies and things in place, that we're not so panicked, or the state isn't so panicked about the functional life left of three quarters of the 194 communities out there, or is 80%, right? And we've already thought ahead and said, wait, we've got programs in place and whatnot to help these people. And guess what? Most of the time you don't have to write a check. You know, you have to grant. Some of you probably will. But if we are ahead of that we have those tools in place, whether you know through the commissioner's office, to you or with Thomas' support, I mean I'm hoping that we're going to get a real rosy report, but I'm fearful that we're going to get a report that says not you know maybe shocking. So I want to manage for...
When is that report supposed to be completed?
Well, we just finished up the contract, and they're starting in September, starting in January to go out and do the assessments in rural Alaska. I can't think of the engineering firm that's doing it.
When was it expected to be done?
It's supposed to be for this spring.
Oh, okay.
April, May timeframe.
Yeah, so I think that'd be a great... I think if you're going down the right path here, we could use that information. And not only the state at resources, but also there's so many federal resources as well that are available, especially through BIA, that if we can look at what the picture looks like and then here's your avenues, that would allay a lot of fears and actually put people on the right path without bogging down the system.
Well, the other thing it does is it both the elected officials and community leaders realize that it is an integral part. I'm not only solving big projects like the Ember Road, but we can reach in and go out, as example, to Cold Bay.
Right.
And do something. Tom, you got any thoughts on this?
Well, it's certainly true. When anyone comes to Ada and they use the word grant, we look towards the Energy Authority. There's no grant in
Ada. And I look behind me going, where's that?
Not a lot of people lined up behind you, Curtis.
I like that. You just dump it right up.
And dump it right up. Curtis, nowhere in here does it like a grant.
You love it like a public.
I know.
I like the way that works. That is clever.
Ada has to figure out a way to get repaid on any deal it does. Interest rates are so low that there's, from a net present value standpoint today, there's not a lot of difference between getting paid back just the principal or getting interest. I mean, interest rates are so darn low that, discounting it back, interest isn't a long ways from zero. But still, somebody's got to pay the principal back. And that's a challenge to rural Alaska. Ada has done financings over the years, Snedisham, but also Dorothy Lake, and probably some I'm not thinking of.
Those are big projects.
Pardon?
Those are big
projects. Yeah, exactly. And there are some threshold...
Maybe a better way to put it, Tom, the interim finance solution until the long-term federal or Denali Commission solutions are put in place would be more appropriate, you know. 2, 3 year, 4 year, I don't know. We're not asking you to do grants, and we got to make sure it's someone that has the responsibility to pay. But there are rural communities out there that are that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are certainly very successful native village corporations that are just have one village, but they have exogenous dollars coming in from the lower 48 in quite surprising amounts.
Why aren't they doing more? Why don't they have their own little energy fund set up to kind of help their villages in their regions?
Well, let's not go down that path. There's a whole litany.
We can talk about that over a beer.
Down to the beans.
Maybe Ada could come up with a... Maybe, Ada can very conveniently find a market for what are called bond anticipation notes. Maybe Ada can be the pioneer in another vehicle called grant anticipation.
I am an applicant.
Yeah,
and turn it over to Curtis, right? Grant anticipation bonds. I love that.
That's actually not a dumb idea.
I think it's brilliant.
I try to avoid dumb ideas, Grant.
No, that is really, I can see where that has merit. I don't know how we're going to get that ship off the ground, but I love it.
So again, if 5% of your missions overlap each other, I want to make sure it's only 5%. There's not an opportunity to get it to 10% that doesn't jeopardize the mission, that doesn't jeopardize your standards or whatnot. And I'm very tickled about the fact that how things are going. And so for me, I want to push more. That you do more and you collaborate more and you get out there. And actually, what I said last night is you make a difference. It's really about making a difference.
Well, we can do things, you know. Let's say there was a big electrical co-op in one region of the state, you know, in rural areas, and there was an opportunity, some economies, if the energy authority took that cooperative over. I mean, ADA could find a way to finance for the energy authority how to buy that, how to move into that. If there were economies of scale in combining existing energy authority programs with that cooperative that's in existence but has very aging structure, and so ADA could find a way to finance the energy authority absorbing that cooperative as an example, and so we want to think about what could be, not just what's been done in the past and how to keep doing that.
If you look at the map, you'll see that essentially the loans and what we participate in is all the urban areas.
Yeah.
Right. And we get hits for that. And I'm trying to figure out a way, collaboratively with an organization that deals in the places we're not. How does ADA get involved with that? How do we do it so that it helps and works? And that's just a statement I want Julia to say.
I was just going to say we should look at the opposite of that too. It's more how do you get that local regional entities to own with assistance from ADA versus the state owned, because that's the mindset that I'm at. Mm-hmm. I'm working with all the communities throughout the state. It's how do we build capacity in the regions and assist them rather than expanding the state presence.
Well, how about knowledge is power? So when you get your report done, which you're going to have here soon, you're going to have knowledge of all the power plants in rural Alaska, correct? Mm-hmm. Now we take that knowledge and it's divided up into regions, correct? So now you have these regions divided up, and they each one of these regions fall under the native corporations. Each have their own region. So how about each region be their own co-op, and then we have a powerhouse rebuild grant fund that we fund with 50% of the money, and the regional corporations fund it with 50% because it's all in their region. It's their co-op. It's their electric co-op in their region, only looking after their people in their region and their villages. Now you got it all divided up in the state.
So I'm going to disagree with that, Bernie. There are people.
Respectfully?
There's state of Alaska residents. They're not their people versus those people.
Okay, I was...
You know
what? And I want to apologize. I should have never said that to you. So I'm going to apologize publicly. I will never do that again.
By the way, that was a mistake. There are non-native people living in rural Alaska.
Yeah.
Okay, that was the dumbest idea I've ever said. But can we... Okay, for the Alaskan citizens in that region...
There you go.
For the Alaskan citizens in that region... They could have a co-op. I mean, you mentioned co-ops. So it would be a co-op in that region that the regional corporation helps fund that grant fund, and we help fund it through the new renewable grant fund that we're going to put bonds. We're going to do it in advance, sell bonds for a fund for just rebuilding Bush, Alaska when needed in the regions. But we don't fund it all. We only fund 50%, and the regional corporations have to fund 50%.
To service all their non-native residents.
To service the residents in that lives in their region.
That are not shareholders of that corporation.
Well, the state does that with airports. Right. I mean, we subsidize non-residents all the time. It's all about commerce. And,
right.
Okay. It might not be a good idea, but I think we ought to run it up the flagpole. It's an idea. And what if they say yes? They got lots of money. All they can say is no.
Yeah. Some have money, some don't. But that's another subject for
it. You know, the problem I see with rural energy is that every little village has their own little powerhouse with their own little. There's no symmetry. If you go up rivers, they're not all the same. They're all different. They're all different manufacturers, different switch gears. It's all that kind of stuff. So if you get a form of co-op, the first thing, to be efficient, you want to fly all Boeing 737s. You don't fly Boeing and Airbus and Embraer and train all these different pilots and have all these spare engines and all that. I mean, but until we see that later, there's going to be some way to attack it, right? Because the first thing I would be asked once I saw the list, because I'd say, well, what kind of assets they are, what manufacturers and whatnot, is there any symmetry between all of them? And if there's no symmetry, now the issue is you've got to systematically start changing it out when it does become, obsolete. So everything's the same.
Standardized. And right now, we do put standardized engines in rural Alaska. As we build the powerhouses today, they're standard. So what Port of Hyden has is what's going to have be was brought out to Tulusac and others. So there were, there's some areas that obviously do have off brands or such. We have a community, Chinig has a I can't remember the generator type, but it's the only one in the state, and they're having problems. We'll have that assessment.
So is there any place the board can help you, whether it's with policies, resolutions, whatever, to help you to facilitate interaction and working and opportunities based on your missions?
There are things that, kind of third rails, but I look back and nobody's here that would perhaps cause trouble. There are things that are too politically hot for Curtis and I to get in initially. For instance, I can't remember the bill number right now, but of course the governor has a bill in the legislature, which got no hearings, I think, to modify what I think is very unusual interpretation of state law that allows municipalities that have oil and gas properties in them to accumulate more than $1 billion in their reserves, as well as fund amazing infrastructure if they sell bonds to do it, to build the reserves. And the source of the debt service, of course, is a first take on state petroleum revenues. And the governor has a bill in that would modify that, and it got no hearings, I believe. The bill's still in there, but
is that PPTS you're talking about?
Yeah. Might be House Bill 59.
And is it the petroleum tax?
No, it's the property tax.
Yeah. Do you remember the bill number? Anyway, might be House Bill 59. Well, maybe a middle ground, if middle ground can be found in 2019, 2020 now in Alaska, and that's quite doubtful. But if it can be, maybe there's a way to leverage some of that money, because it'd be very financeable, a very dependable revenue stream. So maybe a portion of it could be used to pay debt service to build something that is desirable for more of the state than just a particular borough that happens to have oil and gas property. Maybe a port of Anchorage. I mean, you're talking that the total spend is $400 million a year. I mean, that a major a material portion of that could finance even the huge amounts that are being talked about in the context of the Anchorage port.
Are you talking the House and the Senate or have to get along to try to get this done?
Oh, I'm talking about the somebody's lunch. But you know, Curtis and I, it's way beyond us. You know, we're at best staff sergeants, and you know, it would need some, you know, full bird colonels talking about it. You know, and but you know, it right now the money's being spent, you know, for Borough Department of Fish and Game and Borough Jet Fleet and Borough Helicopter Fleet.
And $35 million search and rescue helicopters.
Yeah, and yet we've got a port.
S-76 just bought last year, $35 million.
We've got a port that supposedly, you know, serves some number, 80% or 85% of the state of Alaska residents or something that's, you know, decrepit and needs something. Depending on who does the estimate, from $500 million to $1.5 billion.
We can move that across the inlet and save a whole lot.
Well, there's that too. But anyway, I don't think we need to. You know, I don't know where it's built. I don't know. Ada just does financing. It doesn't do site selection. And but
Tom, I believe that bill the governor has paused and is not supporting it anymore.
Well, you got. Obviously, we got things going on. We all know about that, you know. But anyway, you know, that's a major amount of money, and you could sell quite a bit of debt against a material portion of it to build something that the whole state uses, or a much bigger part of the state uses than a borough that has, in reality, probably 5,000 people.
Shocking that you would say that, Tom. Just shocking.
Well, there was a question about what could be done, and that was an example.
So what's next?
So, anyway.
That's traditional. Yeah.
Bernie Hawkins sidebar. By the helicopter pulling a whale up on the beach, but
that's a new traditional whaling. I didn't even know they had that expensive. But they got the most expensive helicopter in the state. I didn't know that.
They don't know where to spend all their money. Is.
Yeah. My goodness.
Well, so again, I just want to, you know, I don't want to say I'm concerned. I think, as Bernie says, it's not a problem, it's an opportunity. We're gonna have an opportunity when you get to the list. Tom, we have an opportunity to do something in rural Alaska, without jeopardizing our fiduciary responsibility. I want to make sure that it's front and center that we're thinking about that, and that at least for me as a board member, I want to encourage that. And hopefully, at some point in time, I can see something that makes economic sense that contributes and helps rural Alaska. I like Marriott hotels. I like Krispy Kreme donuts, that kind of stuff. But there's more.
We're not so big on the health clubs, though, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I want to be prepared for if this list, if it comes back. I'm hoping the guy that says everything's great, but it's not going to. I don't think
it's going to be there.
But I also think it's an opportunity, like I said, partnering with others, whether it's Denali Commission, DCRA, others. DEC goes out there. They have a rural remote worker program. If we can identify what the needs are, then we can leverage each other's assets.
Yeah, one thing to keep in mind, and I'm looking forward to the conversation, but when that report comes back, we have about 50, 60 communities that are not part of utility. Like Tula's Hack, the community does it. But then you have communities that have AVAC or IPAC or other utilities. That's when we need to have a real conversation with those utilities wanting us to replace their generation, their bulk fuel, and they have a set up utility, and their business plan is for us to buy their infrastructure.
Right, yeah.
I think you have to send them over to Mr. Rate of Return.
Right.
Mr. Grant is
right.
Home for the day.
Right, because that is a conversation. Yeah.
But that's a lot easier because it's essentially a co-op.
Yes,
and they can spread it out.
AVAC's a good model, but AVAC, they take the best of the best, and if it doesn't meet certain thresholds for generation, power generation, or condition, or income, they don't take it.
Come to AVAC if we have to, right? Yes, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Come to AVAC. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They just got some money. They can lend it to you.
The concept people have to have too about talking about rural Alaska. Without the Red Dog Mine and the DeLong Mountain Transportation system, there wouldn't have been a Northwest Arctic Borough. And that area, those villages that are now part of the borough, would still be wholly dependent upon state revenues for schools and everything else. Instead, that payment in lieu of taxes displaces the need for state revenues and allowed a borough to thrive, to survive and thrive. And Ada did that without the DeLong Mountain Transportation.
So the concept behind payment in lieu of taxes is to identify an individual opportunity to get revenue versus taxing the whole political subsidy.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. You see, Juneau, its two largest taxpayers are the two mines. One of them on federal land. And yet, since Juneau already has property taxes, I pay them $15 a day for my house. And so Juneau already has property taxes, so there's no, you know, you couldn't talk Juneau into modifying property taxes for me and going to Greens Creek and saying, we're not going to modify your property taxes, we're going to have you pay a payment in lieu of taxes.
Is that illegal?
Well, the borough's doing it, and Northwest Arctic Borough does it.
Well, but it's a separate deal.
I thought they only did that for government entities. Do they do it for private entities? The payment in lieu of taxes?
Juneau could do it. I'm not saying they will, because they like to tax me that $15 a day, but they could do it. I mean, Red Dog is on native land below. Subsurface rights belong to NANA, as we know, and yet, you know, the Northwest Arctic Borough gets a payment in lieu of taxes, that supports the borough. And like I say, that helps pay for schools and whatnot that prior to Red Dog would be entirely dependent upon the state.
Do they have any other taxes up there in that borough?
I believe the answer is no. Maybe they have a sales tax, but I've been there. I can't remember.
I don't believe there's a sales tax.
Yeah, no, I it might be 100%.
So essentially that mine is supporting whole Northwest Arctic.
That's correct. And enabled it.
It supports it all.
And you could calculate what that means to the state, how that helps the state deficit. I mean, you could calculate, you could do the number and show how much greater the state of Alaska deficit, you know, mismatch, amount out of the permanent fund, however you want to say it, you know, that the state doesn't have to pay because of Red Dog. You could do that arithmetic. Very.
It's a huge number.
Yes.
It's a huge number over the course of the life of that mine. It's huge.
Okay. Well, anyway, so on the Ambler project, is there a way that anybody could tax them or other than the state to do something?
That's
boroughs can tax them. Boroughs can tax. They're going to take. It's in the Northwest Arctic Borough.
Yeah, they
Northwest Arctic Borough.
So they're going to do a PLA, whatever.
They're going to do in lieu of taxes. They do a payment in lieu of taxes. Yeah.
I'm sure they will. You know, Ambler's
I didn't realize the mine was actually in the borough.
Northwest Arctic Borough, yeah.
Yeah, the road, most of the road is in the unorganized borough. But
the mine is pretty much in the Northwest Arctic Borough. So it's
the mineral deposits are pretty.
It's going to be a great deal for them.
Yeah.
Lots of money.
Absolutely. And the Northwest Arctic Borough was in to talk with us week before last, I guess it was. That was a great meeting.
But Trilogy's okay.
I don't want to talk about it here, but it's a great meeting. Pardon?
Trilogy's just fine with paying them. They want to give them payment in lieu of taxes. I mean, they really do want to put this together. They've spent a lot of money. They want to see this thing happen. It's a world class ore body.
Sure.
That's good. So the borough wasn't so, because I was concerned during the presentation about some of the misinformation related to the caribou and the fish, and so the borough is in support of.
But there's a difference between the borough, those corporations, the regional corporations, Nana's versus Doyon. So I've heard that there's still a lot of concern from the village corporations and the regionals as well.
Also the tribal.
And
the tribal organizations.
I would say there's more opposition than there is more opposition than positive.
Day, one will be for something, one will be the same people.
Yeah, but so is Ada, I know this is off topic a little bit, so is Ada involved in trying to provide, marketing the information that Jeff presented?
Yeah, we're funding the EIS. It wouldn't happen without Ada because the BLM isn't about to do it. So we're funding the BLM doing the EIS, and as Mark said, there'll be a record of decision which chooses a route, and if then we go through and get the 404 permit for the road, that right-of-way will belong to Ada for 50 years in just about every way similar to the Long Mountain Transportation.
But it sounds like BLM has given out negative information to the Village Corps, according to what was told today. I mean, they're telling them that this is going to really impact their subsistence lifestyle, and BLM shouldn't do that.
So I met with
and they're working for us, right? We're paying them.
Yeah. Tom, Mark, and I, that was just three of us, right, met with Aaron and Doyon and talked about the process. And from what I understand from that conversation is that the EIS was done very poorly. It was very, very poorly done. And when I was back in D.C. a couple of weeks ago, meeting with the delegation staffers and Kip Knudsen's the governor's staff. So he was getting a lot of negative feedback about the whole public outreach, stakeholder outreach process of the Ambler project.
To nauseam how much they've been out there.
Yeah, but apparently, from the feedback he's getting, it's not being well received. So I wanted to be able to talk to them about that, maybe a different aspect.
But how is it? We're paying BLM, correct me if I got this right, we're paying them to do this EIS, correct? I mean, we're actually funding BLM.
Yes, that's
so
functionally the way it is.
But if they do a poor job, is there a strategy to do a poor job that allows lawsuits?
Well, you've got to say compared to what?
Well, and they do it for
challenge.
Job. Here, it allows their buddies on the environmental side to sue them. To sue us. Okay. See, look at this abandoned idea.
Answer,
it's self-fulfilling, right?
Yeah. But here's the deal. You know, show me where a federal agency has done a better EIS. You've got to do it in the context of compared to what when you say, well, is this good or bad? You know, certainly. Just like when a new governor comes to Juneau, a new president coming to Washington, D.C. can't change 10% of what he or could be a she, some in the White House, wants to change. You've got these entrenched, long-term people, whether they're in an Alaska state agency or a federal agency, that can't be changed, and that's the landscape. That's the reality. It's also a reality that federal agencies and courts and Congress have now made the process longer than any four-year presidential term. And so that's an avenue, obstructionists and a whole industry of obstructionists to stop things. That's the environment. We can spend the next 2 days cursing that or but you got to say compared to what? We operate in the environment, you know, I think actually this EIS process is going as well as anyone possibly should have and could have expected, given that a federal agency has to do it, given that it's going to cross a national park,
So Tom, regardless of that, if we see the road bumps coming up that we need to address, that's all I'm bringing this up for, is if there's something that could possibly stall the project, we should be aware of it and figure out how we're going to fix it. That's all.
So I think I understand the process, and but when Jeff was giving the presentation, I guess the one question that I didn't ask was, I don't understand. So if we know that there's been misinformation that's been given specific to the caribou herd and the culverts, at what point does ADA involve itself in terms of just trying to address that misinformation?
We've done that.
Oh, you
have?
We thoroughly corrected that. I was going to say, you know, Julie, you're a Doyon on shareholder, and I can't, you know, I'm certainly not, and I'm from Juneau, and, you know, I can't tell you anything about Doyon. I don't, you know, but, you know, the way I saw it, and you know, I used to run, I was chief financial officer and then president and chief financial officer of what was at the time a very successful native corporation paying, you know, 100 shares. Well, it was a lot of money.
Pardon? Which one was that?
Buckhorn.
Okay.
And is when we logged all the timber.
Timber.
One township clear cut. And 23,040 acres. And you know, so I have some background, you know, and what I think, you know, Doyon was saying, I mean, look at the, you know, and Aaron Schutt came right out and said it. He said, you know, the trouble with this is, I'm paraphrasing, but as you know, he said, all the impacts are on Doyon land, and all the benefit is on Nana land, and that's what we were talking about as far, you know, and so, you know, Doyon has to have a certain point of view, and you know, because of that, and if you're the CEO of a regional corporation, you know, you're a politician too, and so. You know, you've got to be sensitive to that. And, you know, I have to say that compared to back when I had the state forester job, the environmentalists are awfully quiet. I think there's been a generational change. The people who protested the Vietnam War and then became environmentalists, they're dying off, believe it or not. And somehow the people who came along behind them are busy working and trying to buy a house and whatnot. That's the way I explain some of this. And some of the radical greenies are much more concerned about climate change, and they're big picture people, and we're just little people. And so, to me, the environmental movement is surprisingly quiet. When I had the state forester job, something as big as the Ambler project, when we had a board, in a board meeting, you know, we'd have pickets around here. I mean, I've had protesters come to a timber sale that was going to be 200 acres outside in the Nana. And, you know, and those things don't happen anymore. So I'm pleased enough with where we are. I'm scared to death about how close we are to the White House potentially changing hands, and the ability of the new president, if there is one, to look back 6 months. And, you know, the calendar scares me to death on Ambler. But everything else about the Ambler process, I'm very happy.
Won't Doyon share in the revenue under 7I, 7J from the
animal? Yeah, but Nana, they under 7I, they have to distribute a certain
70%.
Right.
So Doyon will get part of that.
Yeah, but it's not
all of them.
Yeah.
No, see, Jeff told you a key thing, and I think you picked up. You know, the deposit that Nana owns there outright, they bought. So 7I doesn't
fall. Oh, okay.
See, that's what Jeff was telling you.
Trilogy is.
Pardon?
Where Trilogy's at, that's a shared.
Okay. But
that's the biggest one.
Yeah,
Trilogy's the biggest one. They will share under 70% under 7I and 7J.
Just to not drag this out too long, but I just think we need to be aware, regardless, that there. I think the environmental groups are just waiting. The environmental groups often will partner up with the tribal members versus the corporation members. Tribal members don't have any vested interest in the land or, you know, any, you know, they often their cousin, but whatever. it's an issue we need to be aware of. When I was working on Susitna Matana, NGOs were out in full force, nationwide, globally, and it was a big effort to stop that project. So I just think we can't turn a blind eye to this, and we need to figure out a way to be aware and be ahead of it. That's all I'm saying.
You know, I don't blame Doyon if they weren't going to share in it. I don't blame them for not being so up on the road. I mean, what the heck? If there's anything in it for them, why burn that political capital? Because you're right. It's all politics. When you get that high up into a native corporation, it is politics. Politics in the corporation and politics in the state.
So is there any opportunity for the Energy Authority to do something out with these mines?
In what regards?
Well, they're going to be burning diesel, I assume.
No hydro capability.
I think they're all going to be burning LNG, liquefied natural gas.
Well, that's a possibility. I think more importantly is if some of these mines can help support, or depending on where their association with some of the rural communities are. But our mission and task is the rural communities, not
mine.
Industry.
Mm-hmm. But if you could.
But there might be some synergy.
How many communities are they directly going to impact? How many communities in the mining district, in the district?
I think by my count, 12.
Okay, that are going to be directly.
I can't name them.
But direct. What I'm saying is directly impacted. They're in the district.
Yeah. 12.
So there could be a real possibility, because synergy, if they go on LNG or if they go on diesel. It could be a synergy to bring cheap fuel to those 12 communities, you know, as a synergy.
Yes.
Well, they most of them don't want the road to them. That's because they got PCE.
Oh, no.
Seriously.
No, I know.
There's no incentive.
Yeah. So.
Why do I want to bring the road? Why do I want to? You know, I'd rather not have the road and keep my lifestyle than you guys subsidize my power.
So we need to find a way to.
There's got to be some happy medium, right? I mean, I got to be more positive than that.
Sad, actually.
Oh, no, it's not sad. It's turning to something positive.
Well, it goes back to our discussion yesterday about how can we incentivize more rural, renewable energy. And, you know, phase down the cost of the whole energy, so the PCE wouldn't even need to be applicable, right?
Right.
So that's the real answer.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Curtis and I work closely, and, you know, and we certainly always need to be looking for things that haven't been done before. And
I think we disagreed once, and it just took me a day to come around.
So theoretically, you guys will be here longer than 6 months. So it would be nice that maybe 6 months from now, you can give us some positive stuff that's what you guys are working on, some projects or something. I just really, you know, we got a donut hole out there.
Yeah.
And I'm not asking. You know, obviously, we don't want Tom to be the grant guy. But I just think there's some opportunities to work with everybody that we try to do that. It'll take a lot of pressure off the administration.
One thing I do believe is if we advance the Sinawantana, there's going to be a huge opportunity for AIDA to play in that role. I'm saying the permitting side, AEA has traditionally had, but as you go out and look to finance and build it, that's not our core competency, and I don't pretend it to be. So that clearly, if that moves to the next line, that I think is a key that we'll look to ADA.
All right.
Can I also comment on that? You know, when the previous administration came in, they listed all the big projects the state had going, and they put them all on hold. And so maybe everybody has to think about, and projects now are such long duration, big projects, the planning and the environmental process and on. I mean, maybe everybody's got to think about how do we, is there a way to ensure that once a project is underway, it can continue? And maybe the answer is no. Hell no, there's not a way to do that. I don't know. But every time somebody starts a big project in government, you know, they're faced with the reality that even if they're starting on day one of a new administration, and that new administration is gung-ho, you're planning ahead knowing that there's going to be a subsequent administration, and that administration might might be voted into office having run on a platform of stopping that project.
Well, before the tax vetoes, Tom, my answer would be agree to the project and encumber the money, right? But after the oil tax vetoes, the promise, you know, to the oil companies, and spend the money and we'll pay you back,
yeah.
and reneging on that, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
I think maybe it's the more of the 3P model where the state puts up the first amount of money first, it gets spent, and it's enough money to make it very attractive for the private sector to join with the government. The government's already done their thing. And so whoever comes in, the money's spent, and the private people have taken over now.
Yeah.
And the state gleans whatever return that they're doing. And you can do that certainly within 4 years. I think that's how I would look at it. It's a different world out there now, and different pressures. And since we're such tied to such a volatile commodity on the revenues, you could have everybody on lined up for these big projects. But if you don't have the money, you don't have the money. So when you do have the money, get it out. Get the private people with you. You know, we'll put our Red Dog or Ambler. We'll put our money in first. You put it in second. We're gonna get you a right of way and a permit and whatnot, and then we're done. I think that's the model for Watonna. We get the FERC license,
mm-hmm, right,
and we turn it over to them. If we are the private,
go for it.
Who wants 4% rate of return? Build the doggone thing and do power sales agreements and move on. Because it's certainly, we could never do it out of, we've already tried it twice, we could never do it out of the state's bank account.
So what will it take to get to that agreement do we have to have the legislature to approve it? If the governor was to say we're going to pick this project up again and move forward with it?
If he's looking for funding, obviously, it's a topic of conversation a lot. You know, when the Bradley bonds are paid off, there's $12.5 million, the utilities obviously want to say on how that is spent, but part of that is using that kind of funding, using that $1,200 million to bond for $100 million to a license. That's a proposal utilities have discussed before to get them, because the utilities need Susan and Watonna primarily because they have energy goals they have to meet by their boards. And they're not going to hit them without a project like that. And by the time that you do the permitting and you permit and you build Susitna and Watonna, their natural gas generation is going to be tapering off as far as the lifespan. They're already depreciating it now. You add 15 years, it's just going to depreciate further that they can take that Susitna and Watonna power. So like I said, that is one avenue of getting it started. That way it doesn't require legislative approval. It doesn't affect the operating budget. Doesn't affect the capital budget.
Prepared an outline of this for the governor.
The governor's asked about it, and that is an option for it. And he continues to ask probing questions on.
Can we do something as a board to say, you know, we want to pursue this and let's, you know, get off the stick?
Well, the stick. That's a nice way to say it.
My God, you're making me look good. I like this. My God, woman. Oof, this is...
I will say the governor's office has been asking probing questions. We're providing them information on it, but I don't know where they are in a decision.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the day, I mean, there's... It's just a matter of trying to get people to focus on it.
Right, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And if you're not focused on it...
Well, even
so, I'll give you an example. I call it the carrot or the stick. Okay, so the administration comes out with the Attorney General's opinion that local hire is not constitutional, right? It's just not constitutional. And so I mentioned to a few people, including the governor, we're going about it the wrong way. The way you do it is instead of hitting them with a stick, you give an incentive. You incentivize a contractor to hire locally. You give them a bonus. They already do it on the asphalt performance, smoothness, gradations. I said, you give them a bonus if they do the 100% of hire or 95% or whatever thing you give them, you incentivize them. And I said, and the way it works on state projects is, which is 5% of, you know, it's only, I don't know anything, it's 5% of the dollars, it has to be 100% state funded. If there's any right. federal dollars at all, you can't do it. Right. So, and in today's economic world, it may be $20 million worth of work. But it looks really good on the paper when, you know, that we're not going to do local hire. So I said, well, the contractor, when you bid, they're going to bid that bonus into the cost. So if it's a $100 job, they're going to bid, when you get a 5% bonus, they're going to bid $95. Because they know they're going to get that 5 cents. They want the job. So it's not going to cost the state any more money.
And that's not unconstitutional.
And that's not unconstitutional.
Right.
Wow.
It's, you solved the problem.
It's
you,
like veterans.
You know?
And you're already doing that, right? I mean, you're
no.
doing that.
No. No. It's like... But it's about focus. It's, you know, you do the right thing, whatnot.
I agree. I mean,
I read today where the administration looks like they're considering it, which is good. But those are the type of things we have to think about with WTANA.
Yeah.
We you know, 30-second sound bites. But how do we solve the problem? How do we solve the problem that if we give them five options, nothing will ever happen?
Right. Right.
We can't do that. We have to give them two,
mm-hmm.
A or B. And we're going to give you a week to get a decision. And that's where the collaboration between both agencies come into play.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a finance component of it, and obviously the power component.
And really, I'm just saying, on WTANA, we spent $200 million. We're not going to get that back unless we spend the $100 million and you get a project, and then the question is, does the state get the $300 million back?
Yeah, I thought it was 25 to 50.
Well, up to. But, you know, whether...
He's worse than they were yesterday on the dog on Navision.
Right.
You know?
No, we stuck to budget. That was a trick question. That budget's enough. But the fact is we have that, and then the question is when the project, if the project happens, does the state get repaid that money? Is it an investment? Do they put it in lieu to lower the cost of it? But the fact is we've already invested the majority of the money.
That's right.
And we have no chance to reclaim it unless we move forward.
That's a great question. Work on two options to give them. And say we want a decision. Seriously. Work on two options. A and B, and give us a decision.
And there's an urgency because there's now been a time in my lifetime when capital was easier to come by.
Yeah.
Cheaper
and we have
isn't
the
that
right
the truth?
All we got to do is have the license and the private people will take it and run with it.
Yep.
I
for a damn project, you could get all the private funding you want.
No, absolutely.
I think the permanent fund looks seriously at it. If they could get a consistent 4% rate of return.
And invest in Alaska?
They would invest money. They would be an investor.
They'll never get it. Our board will take it first.
And there's plenty of outside entities that would do the same.
But at the end of the day, I mean, it's investing ourselves. It's a big project.
And legislatively, not that they've had a vote recently, but I get asked the question all the time when we're moving forward with it.
Yeah.
And what do you sell on
the board?
I know.
Bipartisan.
People want it.
Yeah.
We should, you know.
Two options. Work it out. Collaborate.
There's your first one.
Yeah, there you go.
Big project. That's not too small.
Yeah.
Greg's got the money.
Hey, at least this will probably move the environmentalist away from the Ambler Road and get them to focus elsewhere.
Get them to focus somewhere else.
You know,
stretch their resources.
You know? Yeah, stretch your resources. I like that.
Well, I'll tell you, they were something that's going to kill you. Know, you're just... They'd be burning big signs of you and effigy if they start doing that. Yeah, that's the holy grail over there.
It'd be the dynamic duel, Curtis and Tom.
Oh, they'd be burning you guys and throwing spears at you. Oh, it'd be great.
Yeah.
The scary part is you would take what's left and showplace it at Chena Hot Springs.
I'd have it in glass cases. I'd charge $15 to come see you guys and all burn up.
Big billboard along the highway. There are two pictures on their faces on it. Do you know these guys?
They used to be pretty good guys.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. Thank you. Thanks for doing this, Curtis.
Yep. No problem.
With the board's indulgence, since Greg's going to have to leave, can we switch around the budget process with investment strategies? Are you guys okay with that? Greg, you okay with that? So that because you said you had to leave at 1:30?
Well, 1:15.
1:15? Okay. Is that all right with you, Tom?
Everything's okay with me. I'm just going to go last with Brenda. I know she's doing so good.
Let me know if you want Bob on. I'll try to line him up to call.
So why don't you let everybody know what you're talking about?
Okay, so I think one of the topics is going to be the possibility of the Treasury Department potentially managing the bond investments for ADA. So rather than answer questions on behalf of the Treasury Department, I'd rather still be a board member and ask our CIO to come on if you think you're going to have those kinds of questions.
Well, I have an answer for that. Great. Excuse me. Oh, okay, I was calling.
I was just,
Okay.
I only heard part of
that. Well, me too, because I was calling you. So.
You're back on the record.
Thank you, Craig. So we're going to talk about investment strategies. We've got fixed income policy, continued investments, internal, external financial investment advisors, and Alaska Permanent Capital Management. So, Tom?
Yeah, well, Brenda and I went over this earlier today, and she is very well-versed.
Okay.
So I wasn't sure what the scope of the discussion would be today, so maybe we could start out with just if you could tell me what you're interested in talking about, and then I've brought a bunch of information. So I just don't want to take up our time talking about something you're not interested in.
Okay. We had talked, you know, in a number of board meetings, we had mentioned investment policy, and we've talked about that we're limited right now, you know, because we haven't come to you and asked, you know, to do something else, to fixed income. And concurrently, our current investment manager's contracts get done in the spring, and, you know, we want a process that expands the scope of that, but we also might want to expand beyond fixed income, et cetera. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about, and Brenda's ready to kind of bring you up to date to how we got where we are today and how we got there.
So I can...
I guess at the end of the day, I want to know what we can do reasonably to get better than 1% rate of return. Yeah. I mean, that's my goal.
That's pretty much where we're at.
Yeah.
So kind of to start off, just so everyone knows, our investment policy is by board resolution. So we actually have a board resolution that outlines ADA's investment policy. It's basically, it's resolution number G0114D, and I brought copies, and it's also out on our website if you want to look there.
What does it say?
And so it's busted out into two different pieces. There's an internal policy for our internally managed funds, which I'm responsible for, and an external policy, which is right now two external money managers.
What's the percentage of our portfolio in each versus external?
Well, let's see. Most of it's in external. Just in round numbers, we've got about $400 million in external. So probably, I don't know what percentage that is of about five. So
80-20.
Yeah, 80-20, something like that. And really, our internal portfolio is just for our day-to-day paying our bills. So I monitor that, and I try to transfer to our externally managed portfolio any excess funds. We're required to have 2 years of operating funds in our internal portfolio. So and we have updated our policy, but it's been a couple years. The last update was for us.
It was in 2001.
That was the original, yeah. And then there's the D after it shows that it has been updated several times.
When was the last time it was updated?
I don't know right off.
2013.
Well, yeah. 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 On the last page, on page 10, it kind of gives you a history of the policy under the effective date. And so what it says is mostly we are able to invest in fixed income, and we also invest right now in the Alaska Municipal League investment pool. There's a lot of detail on what we're allowed to do within those constraints, but that's basically it. One of the things that was asked, I think, at the last board meeting that I brought with me is how much have we paid our external money managers? Mm-hmm. So our external managers are Alaska Permanent Capital Management and Barrow Hanley, and we have contracts with both of them. We paid Alaska Permanent Capital Management in FY19 $228,562, and we paid Barrow Hanley $425,737. So a little over
$600,000.
PCE is a Department of Revenue, the endowment. I don't know what the rate of return on the endowment is right now.
It's quite a bit broader than ADA's. So it doesn't have very many equities. It has some, I believe. It's mostly bonds. So it's similar, but not exactly the same.
And actually, that's in the financial statement. So if I can...
Do you know what the rate of return is on it?
Well, I think Brenda's looking it up, right? I'm going to say it was like 6% last year, but I may be kind of off. So before I say that, let's...
So the legislature put $1 billion in, right?
Yeah.
You're getting 6%.
Well, that's what we have now.
Did the legislature, in the enabling the legislation, put any bookends on the investment strategy for it? Or did you get the revenue to come up with that?
Well, I think it's up to revenue, but what we do, I mean, we manage probably, when you get down to it, probably about 100 funds for different state agencies and corporations, maybe more than that. Most of them are a lot smaller, but some like PC are up to $1 billion. So we either just decide in revenue or we offer, obviously, the different directors the opportunity to provide input and discuss it. In fact, I've talked to Curtis about potentially sitting down with Bob Mitchell to discuss the PCE, but that's how it's done.
Related to your comments from the last board meeting about the treasury fund management, so are you guys in further conversation about that?
Or? We have been. There's been some email traffic back and forth between myself and Department of Revenue since that board meeting. So before we move on to answer Dana's question, in AEA's financial statements, there's a little table on page 45 for the PCE Endowment Fund. And at June 30, 2019, it's like there was a little bit invested in short-term fixed income pool. There was some funds invested in a fixed income broad market pool. And then there were funds invested in some equities, a domestic equity pool, international equity pool, and a real estate investment trust pool. And the details in the financial statements.
Does it give the FY19 return by any chance?
Does it have? I don't have the rate of return in here, no.
I can.
I think you're right. I think I saw it somewhere at 6 or 6.5.
Let me, I'll text to get an answer for you next time.
Okay. So,
way better than one.
Well, you know, so think about that for a minute. We got how much, what's our bank account say? 500 million?
500 million.
So 500 million at 6%, right? We're getting 2% right now, net, all at our P&L statement.
Yeah.
So if you take 500 million at 6%, you just doubled your profit.
Tripled it. Not double, tripled.
Well, you know, we did 30 some million. 30 million. We gave 14 million in a dividend. So we did $30 million, roughly, dollars. So, you know, half of 5% of 500 million is 25 million. So 6%. So I'm saying another 30 million. So you just double it.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at the Callan investment report, which you guys should have gotten a copy of, for September at 9:30. So it looks like in the last year, and this would be from 9:30 to 9:30, our total fund earnings was 8.59%, and the external managers was 10.11%.
Over how long?
That's in a 12-month period from 9:30 to 9:30, according to Callan.
Our ADA's portfolio?
That, yeah. So, and the internal was...
That doesn't make sense.
Well, that's an all-in yield, though, so that's... taking into consideration the unrealized gains.
It's a period of declining interest rates. And so bond values go up when interest rates go down. That's all. I mean, you know, there's no magic.
So, right, recall that we did have, if we remember yesterday's discussion, we went from negative unrealized losses to quite a positive. So remember we took that out of the net income before we calculated dividend. And wasn't that like... almost $30 million.
Well, it was a $30 million swing from one year to the next, $19 million in unrealized gains, though, for the fiscal year 19. If you look at returns according to Callan, for the fiscal year, so June 30 to June 30 for 2019. Total fund earnings were 6.64% rate of return, and then external managers were 7.67%. Internal was 2.23%.
What is the 5-year average?
The 5-year average from 9/30 to 9/30, which is what they give us, is 2.79% for the fund. 2.83 was the target, so it's a little under the target.
What do you think the 5-year average is for the PCE?
I would have no idea on that one.
It's never gone over under five or six percent rate of return. Could you ask that, Greg? 5-year average.
So I got FY19 for the PC was 728.
Okay.
And that's with some stock allocation.
Okay. Ask them what the 5-year average is.
Okay. Well, what did you say we were for FY19?
So from June 30 to June 30, total fund, internal and external together, was 6.64%. External managers was 7.67%.
So the difference would probably be there's a stock component to the PCE, but it's not very high. I'm going to guess that. I think it was about 10%. So otherwise, it's similar. Now, also the internal, just so you know, is very, very short-term investment.
Right.
So you wouldn't expect it to make more than a couple percent.
Exactly.
That's what Tom can give his grants.
So one of the things that came out in the back and forth that I've had with Department of Revenue since our last meeting was our policies. Their policy is different than our policy right now. So ADA's investment policy is more restrictive in different ways than what Treasury is, looking at the same index. So we've limited our money managers a little more.
For historical purposes, why are we more restrictive than Revenue is on there?
Well, since I wasn't involved in the original drafting of the policy, but my understanding of the philosophy behind ADA's investments is you look at ADA as a portfolio in total for risk, and we've got our investments, our loans, and our projects. The loans have some risks. They're tied to the Alaskan economy, so there could be some risk there. Our projects obviously have a little more risk. And ADA's investment portfolio was supposed to be low risk, stable. So my guess is those restrictions were to keep us at a very high quality portfolio with minimal risk.
And that, obviously, I bet you the interest rates were higher back then too.
I'm sure they were. Yeah.
So now, you know, with low interest rates, it kind of almost makes you have to rethink the policy.
And I have started a discussion with Callan previously, and this was before the budget year of last year, of looking at our investment policy and asking them to give us some ideas on how we might change it to have some better returns. And of course, those changes are driven partially by what our risk tolerance is. And they have some ideas. We kind of benched that project because of budget issues and.
Well, I can tell you that the risk tolerance is whatever we decide to do. If we want to change something, it would be less than a certain investment north of the 62 parallel. that's like celebrating Cinco de Mayo.
same thing. I was thinking Cinco de Mayo.
Yeah, where's that?
Yeah.
Okay, so the five-year annualized return is 6.23. And what was it for us?
So for us, the 5-year was 2.79.
Okay.
That's 9/30 to 9/30.
Okay, now Bob did say that we're 70% stock in the PCE fund, so that's actually higher than I was thinking it was. So
and
that
we're currently not allowed to even do equities at all.
Right, we wouldn't, So it wouldn't be comparable at all.
Right. Which is what I was saying when Bob and I were, you know, looking at returns, and he did that analysis. Because our policies are different, it's kind of hard to compare right now.
Although the policy differences are kind of like, well, you know, we'll buy investment-grade corporate bonds to some degree.
Right.
Where I think ADA just buys governments for the most part. So it's
we
kind
do
of
have
small,
corporate bonds. Yeah, but high quality.
So based on, let me jump to the fees. Are the fees reasonable?
You know, we went through a competitive process.
$600,000, $700,000.
Yeah, we went through.
So if Revenue did our investments for us, what would the fees be?
Well, so we basically just prorata whatever the expenses of the department are. We just prorata across all the funds. So now it's 4 basis points, which would be, what was Bob's estimate on there? 4 basis points of 500 million is?
I want to say he thought it was around 200,000. Let me see.
Probably. Sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah.
So that would be a savings of 450, 500 just on fees. And then there was also a differential. We had done a little bit better.
What would the savings be just on fees?
Just on fees was like 450.
$450,000.
Really?
Because well, right now we're paying 200 and something to the AK for cap management, and then 450 to
the
$600,000.
Oh, okay.
450,000 is a hell of a savings, let me tell you.
So one of the
right, because we don't actually charge fees. We just whatever the expense of the department is, we just and we charge ourselves.
So you're not like taking advantage of us, is what you're trying to say.
Or anybody, we can. We'd like to. But.
So Tom, you're back in the day, you're over in revenue. Does it make sense that we ask you and Brenda to coordinate with Greg in revenue to figure out any synergies, if there are any, and a proposed or recommended investment policy change?
Well, Brenda has actually a pretty logical sequence of her presentation, and so unless you want to just say, well...
Well, we don't want to go, you know, these are numbers, right, so we're going to get going.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't want to jump right in front, but you know, here's what I think Brenda and I decided. One, we want to change the investment policy to allow at a minimum some stock index funds to be defined later. You know, I mean, maybe it's an S&P domestic index fund, or and then it's maybe a, you know, a something else index fund at a minimum, a change. Since we've got the end of these managers coming up in the spring, what we talked about, we could certainly, you know, look at an alternative, would be we would consider revenues proposal along with anybody else who proposes, presumably these two outfits that we now have would propose too. I told Brenda, since I'm strongly in favor of switching to revenue, and since, you know, she works for me, it wouldn't be fair for me to be part of a committee. But if she wants to put together a review committee, I won't be on it, and they can evaluate, you know, the proposals that come in, you know, and it, like I say, you know, it'd be sort of a charade if I, you know, got on there too, because I favor, from the standpoint of return and costs and whatnot, I favor going to revenue. I think for optics, deciding to switch from a private sector managers to state managers, we do need a process, you know, because we're going the opposite of what some people would think a Republican administration or maybe anybody else should do. So I think we do need a process, and I think Brenda, you know, is, you know.
So whatever the rationale is, whatever the recommendation is, you can give us a if we'd have done this versus this, true, you know, 5-year. Deal. We would have gone this way for over 5 years, and the fees we would have paid versus we do it this way, it would have been this, and we could actually see something to make a
We can come decision. Close to that, but bear in mind, it wouldn't be exactly apples to apples, because we are more conservative than the same.
So I'm just talking about the fees.
Oh, fees, yeah. Fees, I can tell you right now. Revenue is significantly better.
Brenda, do you normally put this out to RFP annually, or how often do you put this out?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so I was going to say that we go out, I think our current contracts with our external managers are going to term April 1, 2020. I think we had like an initial 2-year term or something like that, and then we've had optional renewals, so we're at the end of the renewal periods now. And that's always been a fully competitive process. then this discussion is more than just our external managers, though, depending on the scope of how we want to do this. Because, like I said, we have internal and external funds. Right now, our custodial bank is KeyBank, who we have a contract with, and it's actually a joint contract with AEA as well. And they provide all of our trust services, and they provide our banking services. And so that's all wrapped up into the same contract. So that's something that we would need to discuss. Too, because when I was talking with Bob with Department of Revenue, he's like, well, maybe you could use our custodial bank. So there's a lot of logistics and things to think about if we're going to make any changes.
Who's
there? What's that?
Who is theirs?
State Street.
What is it?
State Street.
Not a local bank.
Right.
No, well, we have, you know, $30, $40 billion of state funds, so we would use one of the major custodians. So basically what it is, we just have one kind of a amount of money with State Street, and then sub-accounted, you know, between state accounts, different agency and corporation accounts. So, I mean, part of a lot of what we do is, you know, accounting.
Right.
Where we make sure it's all being sub-accounted correctly. State Street does it, we do it. But that's how it would be run. The other thing is we already have a contract with Cowan. So it might be something, again, I won't say this too loud, but we may not need to keep Cowan anymore for ADA because we already have a contract.
And we just signed a new contract with them. Their old contract was just up because they were going to help with our investment policy, and they do our monitoring. So, and that, again, that's also a joint contract with AEA. So those are some details we'd have to work through.
Well, Tom, I mean, at least from my perspective, I'm just one. I think that's a good plan, and I think it should be reviewed. It was a good timing with the contract coming for renewal with the external managers. If you feel that, you know, you'd prejudice or it is, pick three or maybe two, maybe have two employees, you know, your senior team, and bring an outside person in.
Can you email us your presentation and your plan to attack this?
Oh, my plan. Yeah, and I was actually just going to, unless we don't want to spend the time, my general plan was to work on our investment policy so we know what we want to be able to do, and then we can select who's the best person to do that for us, whether that's DOR or we would go out for a competitive.
And the process for doing that.
Yeah, I tended to agree with Tom that I thought it would be better for us to do a competitive process like we've done in the past, mm-hmm. so we can make sure we're getting the best fit for what we want.
Right.
Does the policy have to be approved by the board when you guys amend policy? Does it have to come before the board for approval?
The amended resolution. Yeah,
it has to do with money for sure.
I would say, you know, I'm not a big fan of reinventing the wheel. So if there's policies out there within the state organization that fit our deal, I would encourage you to take a real hard look.
Yeah.
Look at that.
Mm-hmm. Seems like we're going to save a lot of money doing with the state. I mean, just in the fees, it's $500,000 a year just in fees.
But that also means if we want our money, they have to give it to us.
That's
right?
What I was going to say. So you got to make sure you put the downside.
They can't say, we're not paying you, we
right.
want it.
It's a whole different system.
One administration to another.
Yeah.
We changed our mind.
Yeah, and there would be a lot of...
No, you're not getting it Monday.
Right.
There would be a lot of business processes to work through as far as liquidity. Like I said, right now, because our banking is at the same place as our trust accounts, we do a lot of stuff internally because it's the bank talking to itself. So if we have a different custodial bank for investments that's different from our checking accounts, there's going to have to be some different business processes put together and timing, and there's a lot to think about.
Yeah. Okay.
Before we leave this, though, I don't want to gloss over because, you know, Brenda covered it, and is, you know, our investment policy now, and I guess I'd recommend it always take into account that we're a bank, and this investment policy, we're talking about the bank's capital. If you're talking about our total risk and rate of return, our capital is just one part of it, and having it managed for minimum volatility is how we got here, you know, and certainly at the other end of the spectrum, we have, you know, investments that are very high risk, high volatility, and so... We want to be aware that you know, our investment policy was was derived from looking at us as a bank, as opposed to just what can you do with this, what today is $500 million. And
well, Tom, I don't disagree. I think I appreciate you bringing it, but I will also say that you know the revenues policy is it looks at it the same way. Their dollars that they have to protect and be, you know, pays for kids' educations, pays for health and social services, pays for basic things to keep people alive. I mean, that's, I mean, if I was to put what was more important, paying for that, I would have to go to that, you know, as far as functions of everyday life for an Alaska citizen. So that being said, I agree with you 100% that it, you know, it is our foundation. And you know we can't put it at a tremendous risk, but the landscape has changed with interest rates.
Well, revenue can offer us any place we want to be on the risk spectrum. They do REITs, real estate investment trusts internally. They do private equity. Maybe you still do timber and armor.
We do a little bit. So the way it works, we have different investment pools.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the way from short-term treasury bills, which have no risk, to, you know, much riskier things.
Yeah.
And what a corporation or an agency will typically do is work with our CIO to come up with a reasonable allocation between the pools. And that certainly can be something Callan can provide input to. And then we basically do investments in the different pools on behalf of the corporation. So if you really wanted to take no risk, it could be in our short-term treasury pool, which has no risk, but it's probably going to make 2% a year.
Yeah.
Or you could go out a little longer to intermediate, or you could use some of the equities. So you know, we'd figure out, working with Callan, what's the most appropriate. Or not working with Callan, as you prefer, but that would be very typical of what most of the corporations do.
If you did the exact same strategy that we have today, policy today, we gave it to revenue. What I just heard is we're $400,000 or $500,000 is good. Just doing that, right?
For fees.
Right.
Yeah. For fees. Yeah.
And I just want to highlight one of the differences between, you know, one of the differences between what we're doing now, which we have a contract with a set fee schedule, and what we would look at with revenue, is revenue is going to allocate to us what their actual costs are based on a methodology. What we're getting under a contract is a set schedule of fees. So it's a different way that we're going to get charged.
But I think we should thoroughly analyze that too, because
yes.
Again, what they decide to throw into that cost allocation can change year over
yes.
year.
Yeah.
We just need to ask, how much are you going to, you know, what are you going to,
what's the proposal?
Well, I mean, right now it's basically, it works out to 4 basis points.
Yeah, no, okay.
But yeah, it's probably not the kind of thing. It's probably we just do the allocation out. So,
and I only mention that because we get charged that way already for other things like the commissioner's office,
right?
And it's something we have, and it's just something we don't have a lot of control over, which I wanted everyone to just realize that all the
we're a separate corporation.
It doesn't
a 2-year deal. We'll make them. If they're going to change in dollars, they have to give us 6 months' money.
We've tried that, and yeah, that has not been successful.
But Brenda, you're not saying, so the agency chargebacks that, you know, where we are, all are exchanging money with the agencies, this would be different from that, right? Because we're going to be paying a fee. We're not going to be,
I don't think,
you know, how would that work?
I mean, essentially, you know, bookkeeping niceties aside, what we do is we say, what's the cost of running the Treasury Department,
right.
you know, including the ARM board.
Uh-huh.
And then we say, and whatever it is, $100 million, $10 million. And then we divide that amount up pro rata among the 150 or so pools. We allocate that out pro rata among the 150 or so pools that we operate or invest for. And then we just basically, you know, subtract those amounts from the different accounts, obviously accounting for it. So.
Well, so I guess my concern is just, you know, when we every year agency chargebacks go up and there's not an explanation for why, and it's not like you're getting better services, and in fact you're doing oftentimes much, you're getting much less, but for whatever, and there's, and you don't get the number until long after you needed it,
mm-hmm.
and there's no explanation as to why it's suddenly so much higher. And so what I, what
this
I,
is the rest of the story.
I have a red flag.
Yeah.
Should I be concerned? I'm concerned.
I'm concerned. So I think that's why we need to have the pros and the cons of this.
Yeah. So you're not going to be, sorry, but you wouldn't, that wouldn't probably get flushed out in a pro-con analysis from Brenda, probably.
I don't know that I would be able to recalculate what those fees would have been. But.
No, but we could probably reach into Michaela or somebody that has access to that data, admin services director.
I guess that's why I was highlighting, because it is a different, it's a different way that we're going to be paying.
And it's you cannot predict it year over year. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
And you can't get it on time.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But and we have. You can see what it's been over the past 5 years and what the variance has been, so you can get some sense of it, right?
Right.
So the Treasury Division, this is entirely distinct, you know, from if we did select the Treasury Division to replace, to be our external manager. I would guarantee in writing that we wouldn't get any surprises or any obscure, you know, any number that couldn't be explained or any. This is different. The Treasury Division manages money for any nonprofits and.
Right, but we're talking about the costs allocated across departments and divisions. That's the part that you don't have any insight into, the part that you have absolutely zero control over. So that's why I say you'd have to at least do a 5-year analysis to see.
Well, we actually had that. We were looking, Julie and I, at the PCE. And actually, the costs have, I don't know, almost doubled or maybe a little more over 10 years. But most of that's because the assets themselves have almost doubled over that time.
Yeah.
So I would say, I think the idea you had, Tom, is right. So I shouldn't really be saying any of these things, acting as a board member. But it should be Brenda and maybe one board person, not me, obviously, sitting down with Bob Mitchell and kind of working through what the state's proposal might look like. And then I think it should go out for RFP to other managers. And you might also find the managers that we currently use might reduce their fees significantly. So, I mean, having been in this business for years, it's one thing to charge what you can charge, but when you're saying, well, fees are a concern, sometimes you can get a lot lower.
Wow.
How many years have we been in, has Barrow Hanley been providing services to us?
Gosh,
I
don't know off the top of my head. I was involved in the original selection, and it's been, like I said, it's probably been 6 years or so. I know we've had several, you know, optional renewals of the contract, and we're at the end. So it's been a while. It's been a while. I don't remember exactly how long. I can find out, though.
Pretty nice return for them.
Yeah.
I think you're right. They might want to lower that a little bit to keep the count.
I would think they would,
because the optional renewal piece of it, that doesn't go back out as a public process? Or?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just, it's a rollover of their contract until we get to the end. And then I know that since we have mostly new board members, I just wanted to make sure everyone knew that part of our investment policy, we invest in the Alaska Municipal League Investment Pool, and that was a board-authorized investment. And when the board authorized that, they also asked that every 5 years we come back for a renewed authorization. So we're authorized for that investment through June 30 of 2022. Doesn't mean we have to invest in it that long, but just so you know that if we decided to keep in there, we're going to be coming back in a few years to ask for renewed authorization. Anything else?
Further questions?
Did you get everything you need on the Municipal League resolution? I mean, you all set with the board.
Thanks for bringing that up. Oh, I was going to, I can have for an hour.
It's up to you.
Yeah.
I mean, no, I just want to make sure you got what you need.
I've got copies of the resolution authorizing us to invest in the Alaska Municipal League Investment Pool if anybody would like that. Or
I'd beg a copy. I'm curious what it is.
Let me see. I know it's in my piles. Hold on.
I don't know if you wanted to distribute Bob's memo to you, but I wouldn't have any problem with that.
Okay. I didn't bring copies, but I could certainly, we can send it out later. My copy that I have, I did bring the copy, but it's written all over, so I don't think people want that.
Dana, part of the reason I was asking about the RFP and the competitive process is just, I don't know if at some point you want to consider having that in policy, you know, the there could only be a certain, or maybe it already is, but only a certain number of re-ups before you automatically have to go back out.
Oh, sure.
It would force the competitive
question. I thought that was the case. I mean, I've never seen an open-ended, you know, contract like that. Unless, you know.
It isn't the case. I didn't realize that.
So Brenda's going to get back with us on how many years we've...
Yeah.
Thanks for asking that question.
You know, I mean there is a cost to changing, and obviously you don't want to do it every year, but there's a point in time where it's policy, right. Public policy that you go back out.
It's always healthy to be.
Yeah.
Are you looking for...
Or if we find out that money management costs have gone way up and we've got someone locked in, we want to just for us to be able to keep extending it.
If they're performing.
Yeah.
I was on the Joanne Foundation Board and basically managed the Finance Committee. They had this long-term relationship. Was it performing? Trying to get people to actually... agree with change because in long years of relationships and everything took me about 2 years
really?
To change it. And then it was like, fuck, the way I'm doing it for it. See, how come we didn't do this sooner?
Yeah,
original
selection.
Didn't
that go typical?
We saved a lot of money.
Tom and Brenda, one more idea I had was, we actually do RFPs all the time because we hire from time to time external managers. So I'm sure Bob could work with you guys on developing an RFP.
Okay.
I mean, we don't really have any skin in this game. It's kind of like what we do because we have to do it. But
sounds like you do it well. Sounds like you get a good rate of return.
Yeah. I mean, we're certainly willing to help. We've been doing RFPs for so many years. We probably have stuff that you can just use.
And we have too, you know, Callan has helped us in the past with our RFPs. And, yeah, and I know we have copies from the last time we did it, which is what we usually do, and then we kind of update from. We go through our procurement department, yeah. And we do, you know, a full competitive procurement. I was telling Tom the last time we did this, you know, it's a big deal. And so we actually, I think we went down to, I think it was San Francisco or Seattle, and everyone kind of came to a central location. We did interviews for the external money managers. Callan came with us, so we had someone with a technical expertise. I don't remember if we had a board member as part of that or not. We might have. But thank you, Greg. And you know what, I'm thinking that we'll come talk with you more about what the options are too. And like I said, my initial thought was I'd like to update our investment policy to encompass everything we think we might want to do. So, and then we can take the next step to figure out how to do that for us. But include Department of Revenue in there.
Well, let me know how I can help. I gotta go. Thank you.
Before you go, Greg, I just want to do something here. So apparently, someone among us here has 15 years of service to the state of Alaska. And I happen to have here a certificate of appreciation for that person. And he doesn't look like he's 15 or 30 years old. He looks like he's, well, I'm not going to say how old he is, but Tom, this is for you, from Governor Dunleavy.
Oh.
So congratulations.
I'm quite surprised.
So, Dana, were you saying that it didn't look like he had 15 years and you mean it looks like he has 30 years?
No. He forgot to tell you, the governor said there's a nice, healthy raise going with that whole thing.
On the back, it says he wants his mileage back. Well, that wasn't part of the deal. Greg, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Greg.
All right, let's jump back up to the budget process in OMB. When and where would the board like to have input on the budget process? Logs of contracts at department and OMB. So we have Bill and Sandy, Julie, are on the subcommittee, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we let you guys take this and talk with us about, because this really plays into your bailiwick here.
And remember, we had a resolution passed yesterday, which puts the board
in the very beginning days, the first day of it. But then Brenda has information that shows you that it really is an iterative process we have going with the department and OMB. And so we just need a feeling for, and really this would extend equally to Energy Authority, you know, we need a feeling for any other entry points. What I'm trying to say is it's very common in the budget process for us to get a call Monday morning that by close of business Wednesday, they need this, what we do with this kind of cut. Or really, it's always a cut. They never call on a Monday morning and say, we're going to give you some more money.
Right.
We'll
agree with it. It's 4 p.m. and they need to answer by 4:30.
April Fool's joke or something. And so you know, what we're trying to say is, you know, and when that's happened recently, I've always emailed the Budget and Audit Committee with a copy to Dana. And, you know, but if there's something, you know, we're not doing or could be doing that hasn't occurred to us, or, you know, because we know you don't like to learn after the fact.
So I thought the resolution yesterday sort of addressed where we what we were looking for, but you just want more information about when exactly, more direction?
Well, remember yesterday we were talking about let's put our strategy together, which I think we should do like in June, so that we're ahead of the budget process, and then you match your budget to your strategy, and then you present that.
Yeah, and the classic response should be on the request is that per policy, that, you know, the board's put together, we've got a budget that the board's aware of, and if you want us to make a change, we'll have to do that, but we have to run it by the board. And that slows everything down.
But, Tom, you're talking about, so like, I'll get a call on a Monday afternoon says, it looks like you're going to have to give up $250,000, take a look at your PCNs, let us know by end of business today which PCNs you'd cut.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So you're asking, in that scenario, whether or not he needs to roll the board in to that immediately is your question?
I think the answer is that the board meets once a month. Do you want me to hold an emergency meeting?
OMB doesn't.
It?
But
seriously.
OMB is not going to be sympathetic to Tom when he says that.
But also, I think if we set the stage that this is, we want them to back off and say, this is not, no general fund dollars here. We generate our own revenue. We pay our own expenses. Back off. I could see that becoming more pertinent in services world. But then usually we get a heads up on what kind of reductions they're looking for anyway before. And so two different types of scenarios, I think. But I would
more
stress
hardline.
We really need to try and get them to keep their fingers
out
of
it.
I agree.
Yeah.
No, I agree with all of you. I do. But so, Tom, did you get an answer to your question, though?
Jesus.
Well, I don't know if I got a realistic answer because, it's not going to fly with whoever turns out to be the OMB director. And Brenda here has a log of the requests that we've received so far and who's answered them and when.
Oh, that's so smart.
And
that's
you have it too. Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this illustrates the budget process as it now exists.
It's archaic.
It is. It's ridiculous.
It's archaic. I have never seen anything like this that just had to me. Absolutely. Besides saying that the board has to review it, or at least our audit and budget committee has to review it, I'll get back to you. You can say, by the way, we've cut everybody. There's no one here to answer your question.
But this answers your question about yesterday, those people, purple boxes, because look at how many days it takes to prepare some of the stuff. Look at that. It'll make you cry.
Yeah.
How many days we get to prepare it. Sometimes it's like, gosh, we wish we would have had a little longer to work on this. But you're exactly right, the kinds of calls
you get. You can also,
Think about it. Racist to use.
Add this. When you develop your budget and you present it, say, and by the way, you put your schedule together and say, these are the days that we need to be able to respond to these requests, and don't expect anything different.
We started keeping this log a couple years ago because there were so many requests coming in that it was hard to keep track of what came in and what got answered and who was working on it. So this was a way for us to manage all that and make sure that we were being responsive.
The first thing I would recommend is that you tell them all requests go to one person.
Yeah, and we did. All of this goes through one person. And when request things go out, they all go back out through that same person. And there's one person that maintains these logs. It means that other people could be working on it, but we have one point of contact.
There's a difference in my mind between asking a scenario and then saying cut.
Yes.
Right? In scenarios, it's informational that they can then glean and whether how that fits in their big project. Call up and say, we want your cut. Well, what are you thinking? Well, we don't know. And then they come back, well, that's not enough. Come on.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if somebody is on the line.
So we, you know, like Tom was saying, we want to make sure that we fold the committee or the subcommittee under the board in when needed. But I think everyone realizes now, and this illustrates that sometimes those turnaround times are pretty short.
And the board doesn't want, you know, I mean, we aren't asking that staff email us every time one of these requests come to them. Okay.
No.
So is that clear enough?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
But if it's a substantial change to the budget, yes.
And, you know, when when we had a budget subcommittee in the past, we had a specific scenario I'm remembering where we did take some PCN reductions, and it was on the AEA side because of the shrinking of Susitna. And we identified it, and then we actually had, like, a memo that came from the budget subcommittee that said, and we are supporting this change.
Especially they don't even know how many times they ask.
It's ridiculous.
Well, no, because they don't talk to each other. No. That's the other problem.
Yes.
And this also includes legislative requests.
And so why do we have, what makes it pertinent that we have to do this? What laws
we don't have the courage to not do it.
If you said no, OMB would say, perfect, that's what we needed. We'll take it all then.
We're part of the executive budget action, so.
I just think we should treat them like the ugly stepchild and give it a try.
It's why we're advocating for getting out of this monkey business as much as possible.
But,
can't we get out
of it just simply by not doing it?
By statute right now.
Tom, how would you like the job? It's not that great a job, right? In all honesty, you don't.
We're not. We don't want to put the pressure on staff. We'll take it.
Mm-hmm. Happily.
We'll take it. We're basically below poverty level.
Well, let me do it. They can get rid of me.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with me. Why don't you just say, Bernie said.
Let us explain to them the ramifications.
I'll take the heat on this.
Trevor's money.
Huh?
Nothing but time soon.
That's right. You're the closest. You can hop the plane right up.
Don't give me a call.
We'll pay for the charter, Julie.
Perfect.
I will say.
We don't want you to have to wear the vest. You know,
yeah. The board.
This really is a silly process for ADA because we have no general fund. And this governor keeps in touch with all of our projects. If he thinks that one of our projects is too expensive, going too slowly, should drop off, or a new project he has in mind should come to this board and you know, he'd let us know immediately.
Yeah.
And so going through this, there's a disconnect between OMB and the governor since there's no general fund.
But I think the board has to take some of the responsibility for that disconnect. Certainly I do so far in my short ride on this, because I think that message has to be said over and over and over no general fund, stay away from. I mean, the money is being used to invest back in Alaska. The hope would be that it's going to generate revenue, unlike everything else that's getting GF.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, our mission is to do that and to give and a return to the state. There are five public members on this board now, not like the old days. There's five. In the old days, there was more government, you know, commercial level people than there was private people, and so it's completely changed. And our mentality on the private side, you know, even those that people were the private side went to the dark side.
Yeah.
But
she's still Fairbanks.
Yeah, that's right. We won't hurt her too bad. But you know, our mentality is that efficiency, rates of return, and getting things done.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't believe the people you put on a board do that, you got to change. Mm-hmm. Change them. Because that's our mission is to question, do we need to have this? Is it efficient to have that? Mm-hmm. Can we do any more to get better rate of return and get more jobs out there? We think and breathe that every day.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't think OMB understands that.
They don't. And I think that goes back to how we present our budget. This is the board approved budget. And this is all the goals, this is the mission, this is how we've identified efficiency. And you speak to that and just cut them off at the pass.
That,
what
yeah.
are they going to do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I say we just don't answer their bullshit. We just don't do it.
Well, you got to give the heads up first. Then you stop doing it.
Oh, okay.
You tell them, hey, this is we can either do this or we can go out and make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, we can't do both because we've cut to the bone.
But you still, as a board, need a budget to approve for operating plans for your agency going forward.
Yeah. And you need to answer questions so that in the big picture.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'm here to tell you.
But I think it tells a better story.
Way better story.
If we change the process.
This is just like a make work kind of deal, just to make somebody busy.
Yeah. Well, I
to create work.
Again, like I said yesterday, to me, it's taking away from your core business.
Yeah.
This actually creates a lot of work.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
It's a, and you know, mm-hmm. it's a huge amount of work.
I don't see where it benefits you at one bit.
As a board, I think it's the most effective thing we can do to help the agency right now is just.
It's
strategy and to keep saying our strategy.
Yeah, it's frustrating.
Oh my God.
It's six people's time.
Oh.
Well, Tom gave us a dissertation about the budget, how many hours you spent doing something when you shouldn't even have to have done it, right?
Yeah.
You went down there and told them.
Well, multiply this by all the divisions, admin departments, the division of administration.
If you keep talking, he's going to explode. He's going to spontaneously combust if he knows.
We're getting this. Why don't we spell it in dollars and cents and savings and make it so easy for OMB that even a caveman can understand it?
The requirement is really coming from statute. ADA statute says that we're subject to the Executive Budget Act, and because of that, all of this stuff follows.
Why can't
we get a
letter from Jerry, and Jerry just tell him we're not doing it anymore, and stamp it with the AG stamp or whatever he does, and tell him go to hell?
Brenda, you have more wiggle room, even though it says that to get out of some of it. I think we just max out all
this
the places
nothing.
You guys can get out of it.
We're just following the leader.
Jerry, would you mind taking this on and putting this in a letter to them rascals?
I don't think that would be prudent on my part, Murray.
Law's budget goes.
He's trying to retire, but
But
I think you can tell him that the Executive Budget Act is complied with by us giving you the budget, and you don't need to mess around with any more than that.
Yeah. Can you do that in a letter for us, please?
Well, I'll see.
Bill, some of the stuff is in. There are numbers associated with that. Ledge audit has to come and do audits of the agencies, and some of this information is fleshed out. But just so you know, whether or not Ledge audit, once the audit and the report, which by the way, you all are paying for, and some of these studies cost $100,000 or more than that every time they do them. Ask your legislative members whether or not they've read some of those. We're paying for them.
I just like to get some cost numbers.
There are costs.
So I can say, look, we're trying to streamline. We're trying to do everything we can, and you're making it impossible for us to do it.
Yeah. Well, what we're doing is we're missing out on opportunities that we should be doing when our core mission is.
And add those costs in too.
There is a huge amount of time that goes into this.
Not just the cost to do it, the cost of what we're losing, because we're taking away the time.
Yeah, the cost of recruitment and retention, because this piece has a huge impact on the ability for all state agencies to recruit staff.
All those add-ons, and let's come up with a number.
I can tell you this. If I had to do this about the third day, I'd be on that roof jumping off.
That's why I have really small windows in my office.
It took me 22 years to figure it out. I'm coming around.
I'm coming home.
God bless you. If I had to deal with that every day, I'd be feeling like I was yesterday. Wanting
some of us have lost our sense of humor.
That list yesterday, I got that list. I mean, when I feel depressed, if I'm going to pull that list out, I'll feel a lot better than what I had to do.
Exercise and chasing your tail. And yeah. It's also why I've said, take your brain out and put it in your purse before you walk into the office. Because otherwise you're going to be frustrated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you think in this day and age it could be all be automated and very streamlined.
Yeah. Well,
if state agencies
again, I don't think
talk
they know.
To each other, just the PFD. If you think about that database, if state agencies could interface with information like the PFD information, which by the way every resident has registered, think about that. But instead, we have all these separate databases, and they don't interface, and so you can't use the same information. And I know people are working on it, and God bless everyone for the record who's working on it. But it's you would have thought we would have come up with a more efficient way to do this. Yeah.
Well. Okay. Well, we're here to help, and we've got a mission to help. Bill asked for some additional information. I think it's very valuable for us.
We can come up with some costs.
If we could get that.
Yeah.
So that we can take the ball and run with a little bit.
And wait a minute, what about Jerry's letter he's going to write? That's very important too. But
and I'm also thinking about, okay, I just need some ammunition. I'm sitting down with my delegation, and I need to explain this to them. And also, as the cost of what we can't do, if I can show them, because they're not like staff. They don't understand it like staff. So make it simple, but show them what we are doing, and this is the money we're adding into the state, and they're making off of what Ada already does. And can you imagine if you would just free us up for all this time, how much more we could add money to the state? I mean, I make a joke so easy that a caveman can understand, but dealing with some of the legislators sometimes, that's exactly what you have to do.
And that's where our strategy and the white paper is going to come in once we have that. So we're a little ahead. I know you might need it for this week, but for your conversations, but we're sort of jumping the gun because once we talk about our strategy, we've also talked about having an accompanying white paper that goes so that we're all saying the same thing to the same people.
Well, we have that white paper by the end of January.
It's more the administration in this instance that can decide that since we're not general fund, a budget approved by this board is the budget that's going to be included in the governor's budget, since we have no general fund, to me that would make sense. And it would make sense for the reason I just stated. The governor knows our projects, and if he and the chief of staff think we're too slow or too costly on a project or doing a project that's superfluous, or if they know of a project we're working on that some other agency is already out in front of us and that's better, they'll let us know. We do try to be as careful as we can with state dollars. So far this year, we've cut $65,000 now of annual dues and subscriptions. Things were not recurring costs that we've swapped, and so we're always looking for ways to not spend money. We still spend an awful lot of money on outfits like consultants that, you might have shaken hands with even today. Their invoices make me awfully excited, but if you're going to...
That's part of the whole, your operating plan and your strategy going forward. Your use of consultants, how you're managing shared services, all that stuff. That's what you would be preparing for the board to review. And then we go, yes, this is the right allocation of resources, the right level. You found your efficiencies. Bless it, go forward. Or, hey, you might want to look at this. But then it's all vetted through us before it goes to the governor's office.
Right.
Currently,
we're tied to the state budget process and how the state budget is developed. And there's some constraints on that.
I don't even see how you fall into that at all, to be honest with you.
Exactly right.
Mm-hmm. For anything.
Yeah. We're not even a part of the budget.
You take no money? You take no money? I mean, you're not funded? Zero by the
state. They should be focused on what we can do to help you give us bigger dividends.
We've got to figure out a way to help them.
If they want to fund us, we should only pay you know, 5%. That'd be funding us.
But to Bill's point, I understand what you're talking about in terms of timing, because we won't have had an opportunity to really talk about our strategy. And we wouldn't have developed the talking points to that before session. So in the interim, would it be okay, and I'm directing this to the chair, to have staff prepare, as they think about this last year, some talking points that they think are really, like, it's important to talk about the $65,000 reduction in subscription.
You mean for FY21 talking points?
Yeah, and so that we have those, and then you know, of course, now we know, as a side note, we're going to be talking, all of us will be saying, and by the way, we should be exempt from some of
the funds. You can say things like, we tripled our dividend.
Yep.
Right.
Reduced our cost.
Yeah.
But we're at the point now where if we reduce any more, it's going to affect the dividend.
So could staff work on that and then give it to you, Dana, so that you can review it, and then once you bless it, send it out to the rest of the board?
But I want to get something for Bill.
And Tom, what I'm trying to do is I understand the governor's office and staff and OMB, but I'm trying to create a buzz to keep...
Let's not get ahead of the governor's budget rollout.
I understand, but I'm just... I'm please.
Yeah, that would look pretty bad to get ahead of his governor. You've got to get his rollout.
If I can finish... I'm just trying to create a buzz because you went to in front of governor's staff and OMB, and I think you used the words that fell on deaf ears. So by creating the buzz, we keep it here on everybody's mind.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, last year we had, well, actually still this year, but, you know, last February we had the beginning of what was a bizarre process, and you know, we had a huge cut, of course, in the governor's budget, and since it was the governor's budget, I had to be awfully careful about advocating for something other than the governor's budget. And so anyway, we just can't do with it.
I didn't know you could do the two-step that well, Tom.
I know. I didn't know either.
But truly, we really need to be conscious of the fact that we don't have any discussions on the budget until the budget's rolled out.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that good enough for this?
It sure is. And I think now Brenda has, in answer to the board, she's got two resolution reports. And I've got copies right here.
Okay. I've got the copies here.
Yeah.
So Commissioner Anderson, I think, is going to be trying to leave us on three.
Okay.
She's going to try, so I want to get...
I bet we're done by...
Okay, I want to get through executive session before she leaves.
Yeah.
Can I
talk to
you about the budget?
Yeah.
Certainly.
Thank you. I just want, and I don't know that everybody knows this, but about 5 years ago, I did an audit of what we were paying for long-distance services for our agencies. And went out, Terrence and I, IT, went out and found it's now called Logging In, but Citrix, and it was called, now it's Open Voice or something. And so we switched our long distance service from the current provider, I think that the state used, to this other agency, and we have saved $50,000 a year for the last 5 years.
Wow, that's great.
Because the rates they charge are so much lower. I'm very proud of that.
You should be.
Even though it was a very annoying process.
Well, thank you for letting us know that, Sherry. I didn't know that.
So why doesn't the state do that all over? You could save $50,000 in each organization.
It's about his computer. So you have to purchase the computers through the state contract. You can't opt out. And you could go to Walmart, purchase them cheaper, or somewhere else. But you can't do that. You have to use it. That is not novel. It'll frighten you.
Really, I was having a good day.
I would never make a good state employee ever. I wouldn't be worth a damn.
I told you 3 days, I'd be off the roof, man.
I could never make one.
Like this.
Well, I could probably never get hired anyway, to be honest with you. So, you know.
I'd hire you. We've got positions open, bro.
Yeah. Well, I'd be good in healthcare.
I did that last 6 months. I got out of college, that lasted 6 months.
You worked for the state?
To the day.
You worked for the state?
I said, they said, well, how long commitment? I said, I'll give you 6 months.
Where'd
to
you work for the
out.
State? Yeah, where was that?
It was in Fairbanks.
For the state?
For the state. I lasted. My agreement was, I said, they said, well, you know, how long can you give us a commitment? I said, I'll try it for 6 months. After about 3 days, I'm looking at the calendar. I said, I gave my word, and that's the biggest thing for me is my word. I give someone my word. And I just started mocking off the days. And 6 months of the day, of course, they knew. But yeah.
So you looked your feature one then.
Am I?
I think so.
6 months long enough?
I think so. Big service, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. But to be vested, you have to come back and work
right.
four and a half more years.
Doesn't this count?
No.
He gets paid.
We've got openings at the Pioneer Home if you want to apply.
Do I get a room?
We need a controller.
Pioneer Home, if you're tired, can you just take a bed?
Yeah, that was 1980. Is it sophomore tier one?
Yeah.
Tier one,
I think so.
You got to finish your time, man. That's good stuff. You get like good medical, right? Good retirement. Medical, they say, is fabulous.
I think you have to be a year there or something. Oh, yeah.
I think the time is up to come back. They sunsetted that.
Oh, did
well,
they?
Can't they make some exception for him?
State lost that case. I think they did too. Yeah. I called them. Yeah.
Well, this has got to count.
I'm not sure it doesn't, but I'm not the right guy.
Well, he's an employee in the state.
We'll start giving you a list of positions available every month. You can apply.
He has a PBN.
Retirement.
Yeah. They fill out tables. They do all the entire paperwork. They get
the information.
Question on a 6 month thing. If these board meetings.
I agree.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Greg might have, you know, since he's a staff at Armswood, he might have been able to answer that.
You might want to check into that. I'm getting some kind of retirement statement. I mean, it's only a couple dollars, but I'm getting some sort of statement.
You've been an employee since you started on this board. You all have.
I don't want to be. I'm dropping out.
Well, when you filled out all your new hire paperwork, when you became a board member, you were assigned a PCN number, and that's how
you joined the
bureaucrat. You're a bureaucrat. What's that called? Yeah.
I don't think about a duck.
Okay, back to this.
Yep.
I shouldn't have said anything about working for the state, but.
So these are.
You've ruined my day.
You can see what these are balances in the first the loan resolutions and then the board, resolutions by category of spending. And I don't know which you want to look at first, but.
I can help explain what you're looking at if that's helpful. So, and also kind of a little bit about process. So when the board authorizes a loan, like we had yesterday, Chris's shop takes care of that and they track that. So the first sheet that you have is the loan resolutions authorized by the board. And we picked a start date to answer your question because I didn't think we wanted to go back until like the beginning of time. So we just went 5 years back. So what you're looking at is starting in 2015 at the bottom of the report, going forward, the date of the resolution, the tracking number that we have, the loan, the ADA participation amount that was authorized in the board resolution, and then the funded amount authorized, yes or no. If the answer is no, like on the very first loan for $3.7 million, that means we haven't funded it yet. And then if you go over to the fund expiration date, 3/6 of 2020 is when the commitment is going to expire for that loan. If the answer is yes, like on the next line down, the $17.4 million, that means we funded that loan for the dollar amount that's noted.
So, so looking on page 2, I see some building maintenance capital work.
Yes.
Is still open?
Let's talk about page 2. So page 2, we went back 5 years and looked at resolutions that had specific board-authorized budgets. You know, some resolution that you authorize authorizes to go do something, but maybe there's not a specific dollar amount associated with it. So this is a limited report. The resolution number, and let's talk about process.
So when the board authorizes a dollar amount, and let's take the 1.5 million, the ADA pre-feasibility studies, the first line on the report, G1118, which is the only resolution that is prior to 2015 on this report, because I know it's still open. When you authorize money, we go to the project manager, finance goes to project manager and request that a budget be prepared that supports that dollar amount that was authorized. And then we have an internal document, we do that. That budget is loaded into our accounting system. And there's
the pre-feasibility study, that's where the people who come in and request, we participate with them?
No, this was the G1118 funds. So this is the resolution that back in 2011.
But it's open.
Yes, it's open because we still have funds that are encumbered against this, that they're, yeah.
Can you show that the total, the 1.5 million is encumbered?
It's that total column is if there's actuals, encumbrances, or commitments outstanding against that.
So when you
line.
Give us a balance, is that net of encumbrances?
Yes, this board approval less total would be net of encumbrances.
Can we look at our cash?
Oh, bank? Cash is different.
Yeah, but
well, so maybe we can get another number, because when I think of, you know, when I look at an asset, a current asset, that means it's in play. It's probably wrong, but it's in play. But if there is a liability against it, an encumbrance, it would be nice to know that.
I see what you're saying. So what we're looking at here is an authorization. Then the next column, the actuals, encumbrances, and commitments. Actuals mean expenditures, like we've paid an invoice for something. Encumbrances mean we have a legal liability to pay a vendor if they do what we've asked them to do.
So the legislator looks at our balance sheet.
So our balance sheet only shows actuals. So if you're looking at ADA's financial statements,
right.
Only actuals.
So the encumbrances aren't in there?
No.
So there's got to be a place to put encumbrances as a liability against current liability or something. Because if I see $500 million, but you got $100 million committed, even though you still have the cash, I'm getting a false picture, right?
Yeah.
So under GAAP reporting and which we're required to do for our financial statements, that's not something that we can put in our financial statements.
Is that a liability?
We can.
No.
It's got to be a current liability.
Because it's not a liability. Say we have a contract with you, and we give you a notice to proceed, to go out and do something. Until you've actually done the work, we don't have a liability to pay you. But what we do is, for budgetary purposes, we set aside those funds, which is what this is doing. We're saying we're going to pay you if you do what we've asked you to do.
But we can add that, couldn't we? I mean, to something so that the legislature sees that those are funds that we've got set aside. You know, they're restricted funds, essentially. So we've got the restricted and the unrestricted.
I'm going to stretch it as far as pre-flights.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Again, one of the things we talked about last session was these people are coming in, they're spending money and time and doing all the efforts. One of the banks that come in, I need a $10 million loan. Oh, by the way, the legislature thinks we have $400 million, they're going to take $254 million. Oh, wait, we got $50 million in pre-flights that we've kind of committed to. I mean, we've got to bridge that gap.
In our financial statements, we talked about this because I remembered your request from last year. If you go to the management's discussion and analysis in our financial statements, in the Outlook section, which is where we can talk about that kind of stuff.
They're not going to look at that, Brenda. No. We're going to look at the current assets and current liabilities. They're going to look at the bottom line,
take what they want and have no reason why they take it.
That's right.
Is there any way to add that restricted and unrestricted on the short version of what we pass on to the legislature?
I don't see why you couldn't put that in your presentation.
Well, we did talk about it in our budget presentation.
Yeah.
We highlighted how pre-flight.
Put it in red.
And
ad-lib, like a lot.
When you go in front of the legislature, make sure you include that.
And I want to say that was like the first page of our heads-up presentation this year. We included pre-fight.
We include those, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. When we first saw the budget on February 13, 2019, and we're surprised to see $254 million coming out of ADA's revolving fund in the governor's budget, that had been inserted by two people. One, a former Department of Revenue employee would sit on the board, and a revenue commissioner at that time, who had also earlier been a deputy commissioner sitting on the board, right where that deputy commissioner now sits. And it was Bruce Tangeman and Mike Barnhill.
Oh, no.
Commissioner, yeah. And they knew this, you know. They knew this, but they probably didn't reveal it to Donna Arduin. I don't know, but they probably didn't. But they knew this. They had been on our board, you know. But the first thing we did then to push back, Brenda prepared a big spreadsheet and in executive session, yet today we're going to see actually the newest version of that spreadsheet. The first thing we did, we went to everybody, the governor, the guy who's now chief of staff, and the revenue debt manager and on, and said, look it. Here's why this is wrong. Here's our encumbrances. Here's our pre-flights. We don't have anywhere near enough cash to give you $254 million. And the people who submitted it knew that. You know, I doubt Donna Arduin did because she was at 40,000 feet.
Right.
But the people who gave her that number, they knew it. And so government has a lot of those kinds of games.
Can you check in with Mike? I mean, I don't think Tom should.
He would.
I would love an explanation of that process or thoughts or, I mean.
With Barnhill?
Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna make a point to see him when I go down to Juneau in February.
Okay.
So, yeah, like when we did our heads-up presentation, like I was saying yesterday, what I tried to do is to spin the prism, as Fred Parody would say, and put all of that information at the front end of our budget presentation. And we were going to use that same presentation, I think, when we go to talk to the legislature this year, which highlights the pre-flights, the projects we're working on, our project pipeline, the things that you don't see in our financial statements, we tried to highlight in the budget presentation.
But is it essential for the chair to have a conversation sooner rather than later, just to have that discussion of what happened and to prevent that possibility from occurring again?
Well, the budget's coming out next week. I mean, unfortunately, I don't have time.
Well, Tom knows what's in the budget.
Fire up a jet.
Yeah, we don't expect to see a repeat of that.
Okay.
I'm a little concerned, and I'm not going to point any fingers at anybody to blame. I can remember, I'm down in Juneau, it's February, first week of February. I'm up on the third floor in the tall guy's office with his current chief of staff, and we're talking about a few things, and he says, and I get told by chief staff, well, by the way, it's 185 or 184 million we're going to take out of ADA's fund. I go, well, that pretty much puts us out of business. He says, well, don't worry, we have a way that we're going to put it back in. I said, okay, well, I'm not going to, seriously. Actually, I was walking downstairs just leaving the office, and he ran down to get me to tell me. Next thing I know, it's 254 with no way to put it back in. So, you know, at the end of the day, there's a complete disconnect there, and you don't know what to fix if you don't know what's broke.
That's right.
Right.
And it causes a little distrust.
Well, I'm not to get hysterical about it then. So I'm going to assume that everybody's aware that the budget process didn't go well last year and that things will be different this year.
Well, yeah. It opened it up. As I said yesterday, it opened
it up. You say it didn't go well last year?
Based on our dinner last night and why we had to go to dinner.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
We're not scheduled to go to Juneau until February, of course. So.
But the fellow who, you know, most reliably and loud, the loudest person who went to bat for us is now chief of staff. That gives us some assurance, you know, that we'll have.
You guys assured us yesterday, right?
Yeah.
So we're all good.
Well, yes, on the vetoes of stuff taken out.
Yeah.
So.
I'll remind you, this is a public session, and you're on the phone. Could be somebody.
Yep.
Oh my God.
Anyway, you know, I think there's a better team. I think we have to tell our story, and fulfill our mission. You know, quite frankly, since day one, I've been telling everybody that we have to build our balance sheet. Projects are not what they want to do. Any governor wants to do, any administration, even legislator, they're not $3 or $5 million projects. they're 50 to 100 million. And you got to have a balance sheet to do it. Now, I know there's no cash to do it, but there's some assets to do it. And I, you know, one's Bradley Lake, but we can monetize. There are ways to build our balance sheet. It just takes someone to focus to say, hey, yes, we want to do that. Let's help Ada out to do it. That's there's a way to do it without giving us cash.
Mm-hmm. So, but getting back to the second worksheet that you have, which is the non-loan authorizations. As I was saying, we have a process, a budget's loaded. All of the costs, encumbrances, commitments that are associated with that authorization are recorded against that budget. And the, so the report you have gives you the resolutions going back to 2015 with the exception of G1118, description of the resolution, when it was approved, the authorized amount by the board, a total, which, like I said, is actuals, encumbrances, and commitments, and then the remaining balance, and then a status. And the status, once something is closed, we actually go into our system and block that item so nothing more can be charged to it. There's a remaining balance, as you'll note, on some of these things that are noted as closed. For example, the G1501, the second line, there's $73,000. All that is a remaining amount comparing what was authorized to what we actually spent. When we budget for these things, but we don't restrict cash or anything like that, because there's, in order for us to restrict cash, it has to be a third-party restriction. So these are internal restrictions to us. You know, the board has said we're giving you this authorization, so it's just budget. And we keep the board-approved amounts in our system so we can track against what was originally authorized and what we actually spent.
So when we get financial, you know, in-house or whatever, mm-hmm. could you put in there the line about what's encumbered?
Sure. In our in-house management reports, do that.
On the current side or the liability side?
Yep.
Or just put the cash amount that we have and put parentheses, including encumbered. Something.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Something very simple.
Yep.
Yeah, a material and substantial amount of the above is actually already encumbered.
We can definitely do that.
Or it could be a net. We could have cash, parentheses, unencumbered.
Yeah.
That's one number. We know what that is.
Yep. No problem.
Yep. It's a great idea.
And then once these are closed, any remaining balances just get cleared off the encumbrances?
Well, when we close something, we want to make sure that we have either paid the encumbrances or we release them. And when we release an encumbrance that's with an outside vendor, we reach out to the vendor. We say, hey, we think we're done. Do you agree? This is how much we think we spent. If we're all in agreement, we're going to close this and we're done. And then we release that encumbrance from our system. And then we also make sure we don't have any commitments. Commitments for us is like a pre-encumbrance. So it's when a project manager says, you know, I think I want somebody to do something like this, and it kind of starts the process. We set aside what they think they're going to spend, and then we go through until we actually have a legal obligation with that vendor, and then it becomes a commitment or an encumbrance.
And then at what point does it come off this list?
What's that?
And at what point does it come off this list?
Oh, well, this was something that was generated. This is actually a JET report that came out of our accounting system. This isn't a report that we would usually use. But we, like I said, it had a smaller scope to try to meet what you were looking for. But we've got our own internal reports that are not as pretty as this that we use for tracking everything.
So I get invoices to sign constantly. And, you know, on there are the coding that shows that I'm not going to approve payment for something that didn't go through this process, so I'm assured that I'm signing this. I still look at the invoice and swear about, you know, the costs and whatnot, but I'm assured that I can sign that knowing that you guys approved it, that we're not spending over what you guys approved by me signing this. You know, those things are necessary because I none of us can keep all this in our heads, and so this is a process. And of course, you know, these are this division, you know, is what allows us to do reports like this, and our upgrades presumably will allow us to do it even better.
And so, and just process-wise, too, and where responsibilities lie, so there's good controls and checks and balances. Finance controls, you know, making sure the budget's in, making sure invoices get paid, making sure we have encumbrances. The project managers manage within that budget. So they're managing the scope of the work. They're managing to make sure that they're doing what we're supposed to do. Every budget that comes through and every encumbrance and commitment that comes through, finance has oversight to make sure that what the project manager is asking to do is within the scope of the money that we have to do it and that we have enough money. There's budget reports that are provided that support all this. But what we've tried to do is build a process that there's controls to make sure that what you've authorized, someone's working on it that's supposed to know they're within the scope. That authorization isn't loaded unless it's been approved by the executive director and the board. You know, everything's in place. And so when we go to do a procurement, we're never asking for people to do work without knowing that we have the money that's been authorized to do it and pay for it. So okay. That's a big picture.
Okay. Hey, we're keeping you active, Kren.
Yeah. Any questions? Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So, Tom, do you think it'd be better to go in executive session now?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So, I will make the motion that the board goes in executive session to discuss legislative strategies, cash flows, future Ambler investment, and Bradley Lake.
Second.
No.
Okay. Phones are going to be put on mute while the board is in executive session. You're back on the record.
Thank you. I'll advise that the board did not take any material action during our executive session. And we are back in regular session. Okay, so let's see. Did we go through everything here, Tom? I think we got everything. We're down to board comments.
Yeah.
All right. Or do you want to make some comments? Or
I don't need to, Chris.
I'm good.
Yeah. Brenda? No? Jerry? No comments? Okay. Board comments. Bill?
Well, I think this was a lot easier than yesterday. I don't need several glasses of wine today. But I like these meetings, and I'll tell you, I would like to see more work sessions. It would help me get more up to speed a lot faster. And I'll tell you something else. If I could get a cheat sheet on the acronyms.
Yes, sir.
Because sometimes I get a little lost in that. I'll tell you, they did that for me at MEA, and it accelerated my understanding a whole lot quicker.
Thanks, Bill. Julie?
Good meeting. I think it's highlighted some areas where we need to be more involved, and I agree with you. It's important that we take the time to really understand what's happening. So I appreciated all the discussion and insight. Okay. Look forward to more.
Thank you. Bernie?
Well, as always, I'm just damn thankful to be damn thankful. Makes me damn thankful. So I'm just damn thankful. Thank you.
Julie?
I just appreciate all the work. As always, staff put a lot of time into the information for the presentations, and I appreciate all the staff time. And it was, both days were good meetings, so thank you.
Well, obviously, I got 2 days. Sherry, Corinne, Brenda, Ashton. You know, there's a lot here, of course. Tom and Curtis, you and your staff, we appreciate that. Look at Jerry, he's got his name on that seat now. So appreciate all that. I think the using something what Bernie says is that we got a lot of opportunity here, and we can't lose the fact there may be some I would call switchbacks in the road, but we are going to go forward and get it figured out. And make it the best we can for the citizens of the state, whether it's on the energy side or the ADA side. I think that's that's everybody's goals, and we have to remember that when we as we move forward. Now, you know, I think as a board we have committed to both Tom and Curtis on budget stuff to help them out and get the message out. The onus is on us now. Of course, we need the information from Tom and Curtis to help them. You know, it has to do with reports and people requesting information on budget stuff and changes and whatnot. So, we as a board is committed to do that. So I want to remind everybody that we are here to do that. And I guess my first trip is February. If I have to go earlier for some other reason, you know, you guys have to let me know. I'll go. I'm sure Julie will come up if I can or somebody can't. You know, she's easy from, you know, spending Trevor's money down there.
I'm happy to spend Trevor's money in any way I can.
Ketchikan, we are a resource and we are an asset. And we want you to use us.
You can take your boat from Ketchikan to Juneau, can't you?
No.
You said you had a boat.
Not on purpose.
Very.
Oh, no.
So she's got a boat. Yeah, I know. So that being said, that's a great result of 2 days of meetings here. And I also want to reiterate how appreciative I am of the two organizations working together and any differences in resolving those, getting it done quickly with a higher calling at your beck and to do it for that reason. So that, very appreciative. And I noticed a difference from previous years, and I think that's great. So that being said, that's my comments. Unless anybody has any follow-up, I will ask for a motion for adjournment.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Thank you very much. Thanks.